from the high desert of the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening or good morning across all these many prolific time zones. From the Tahitian Hawaiian island chains out west to the Caribbean, the erupting Caribbean in the east and the U.S. Virgin Islands, Montserrat, check it out. It may not be there very much longer. South into the jungles of South America, north to the pole and worldwide on ye olde internet. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell, and I've got a bunch of announcements. And then I've got a really good guest for you. His name is David Adair, and he is a rocket scientist. Sounds interesting, doesn't it? David Adair coming up this evening. Let me give you some idea of what is to come yet this week. Tomorrow night, I have a mystery guest. I can't tell you about tomorrow night's guest yet. And so I better keep my mouth shut. I just can't really. Oh, yes, tomorrow night I can talk about it. It's the next night I can't talk about. Tomorrow night is really going to be cool. Check this out. James Collier, who wrote Vote Scam, I interviewed him a long time ago when he wrote Vote Scam, has authored a new book suggesting that we never went to the moon. We never went to the moon. You know, Capricorn 1, done on a sound stage, that sort of thing, and claims to have proof that we never went to the moon. Well, tomorrow night, James Collier and Richard Hoagland debate whether we went to the moon. That should be a really, really, really interesting program, no doubt about it. So that's tomorrow night, and then the next night is a mystery guest, but it's going to be hot stuff if it happens. You know, it's one of those things. And then Friday night, Saturday morning, Dr. Michio Kaku, who is a theoretical physicist at the City University of New York, a professor in the field. And then come Monday, I believe we've about got it firmed up. Come Monday, James Von Trog is going to be here. So there's some hot stuff happening out there, folks. All right, last night I announced KNST in Tucson, Arizona, joining the network. They didn't hear it because they had, you know, typical first night jittery troubles in the first 20 minutes of the program. So I would like to welcome, and I'm sure everybody in Tucson is glad to hear, that KNST will now carry the entire program from 10 o'clock at night to 3 in the morning Pacific, Sunday through Friday. That's a lot of carriage. Welcome to the network, and I'm sure a lot of people have been screeching bloody murder down in Tucson are happy to hear that. So there you are. Now, the rogue market. This is really serious stuff. This is really serious stuff. The rogue market. I now appeal to everybody within arm's reach of a computer. Want to make some money, even though it's not real money? Well, there is this very cool thing called the rogue market. It's on the internet, and it trades in literally thousands of personalities, television, radio, movies, that sort of thing. I discovered it about 3 weeks ago. I discovered I was part of it, and I went to somebody sent me a fax and said, you better go up there and look, you're being traded. I went, huh? And so I went up there and looked, and there I was with Oliver North, Dr. Laura Schlesinger, Rush Limbaugh, Howard Stern, Don Imus, and some others. There I was. And my stock had just been offered. And I was, of course, very low at that point compared to others. Now my stock is beginning to go through the roof, and I'm telling you all right now, buy now. Buy hard. You're not really risking any money at all. There's no money involved. But it is like trading in the real stock market. It's the doggonest thing, and it's a lot of fun. So if you go to my website and click on the rogue market, You can zoom over there, fill out their form. If you fill out part of it, they give you 10,000 Rogue Market dollars to begin with. Then, if you fill out the rest of the form, you get 5,000 more. So you start with $15,000, which you should invest in me totally. It's all just for fun, but I am now 10 points from catching up to Stern, Howard. And then once I pass Stern, Howard, I'm going after Imus, Don. And when I pass Imus, Don, there is going to be, that'll be it. We'll be at the top of the heap. And here's why I'm telling you to buy now and quickly. Because when I say something like this, everybody's going to go rushing up there and buy, and the worth of the stock is going to go up, 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 and you're going to make a lot of money. So, whatever else you do tonight, if you can lay your hands on a computer, I'm telling you, go up to my website, click on the Rogue Market, get involved. You'll see how to do it. It'll take a little fooling around. You'll see how to do it. You go down to the bottom when you get there, and you register, and you fill out the form. You get the money for free. And it is a blast. You can go back every day and check. There are statistics. You can see highs and lows for the day. It's really a lot of fun, but I now am entering the Rogue Market in a big way. So please, oh, please, go up there. Buy Art Bell stock until it hurts. So there is that. There is also on my website, and it is going to be particularly relevant tonight, a photograph of Area 51. It's the best damn photograph of Area 51 I've ever seen. Maybe too good. I'm waiting for the men in black. You should see it while it's there. We're going to be talking with David Adair about Area 51 along with a lot of other things, so it is relevant. Take a look. It's really a cool shot. I don't know who and how they got this shot of Area 51, but it's an awful lot of stuff for a place that doesn't exist. And there are a couple of very interesting things in the photograph. See if you can find them. I'm getting a ton of email about it. So, let's see. I told you about Canis T in Tucson. I've told you about Rogue Market. Bye, bye, bye. And what's coming up in the next few days. The only other thing I want to do is alert you. I want to say this again, if I can find it. I'm going to be in Alaska, and I've got a schedule of roughly when I'm going to be where. In Juneau, Alaska, Tuesday, August 26th till midnight, from like afternoon to midnight or something. In Skagway, Alaska, Wednesday, August 27th till about 7 at night. In Seward, Alaska, by 9 a.m. in the morning, August 30th, and then by about 12:30 in the afternoon, I will be in Anchorage near my old alma mater, KENI, and I'll spend the night in Anchorage. I'll stay in Anchorage overnight. So there you have it. Let's see. This is such a cool, cool photograph of Area 51. We're going to be asking David Adair, I guarantee you, in a few moments about Area 51, and I'll tell you more about David Adair. He's a cool guy. David Adair's new book, America's Fall from Space, not Grace, maybe both, tells the story of the U.S. space program through the eyes of a child prodigy turned rocket scientist. My kind of guy. He is an internationally recognized leader and expert in space technology, consulting the world's top corporations. He crossed swords with NASA as he learned of the corruption and technical problems faced by the Challenger shuttle prior to launch. David will share just where the current space technology really is at, as opposed to what we see, as well as the testimony he gave under oath on April 9th, 1997, to the U.S. Congress on, check it out, folks, extraterrestrial intelligence, recovered extraterrestrial hardware, reverse engineering of downed ET spacecraft. He has first-hand experience of top-secret underground Air Force bases like Area 51. He has, where he had, hands-on experience with the technology from a recovered UFO. He claims that reverse engineering The investigation into what makes downed UFOs work has been responsible for inventions such as fax machines, modems, cellular telephones, laptop computers. David says, quote, "You're not going to believe what's going to happen in the next 10 years." Now, that's a much, much better introduction than he sent me of himself. Here is David Adair. Hello, David.
How you doing, Art?
That was pretty good, huh?
It was too good. It was great.
All right. Let us go back to our childhoods for a moment, David. A child prodigy. When I was a little child, I built a lot of rockets, David. I also built a lot of bombs that I thought were rockets. And the only way I knew to do it was to create, out of either metal or cardboard, rocket bodies, which I would then, remember the old Ohio blue tip matches?
Sure do.
If you break off those little ends with the blue tip,
right,
and you break off millions of them, and you put it into the body of a rocket, you get rocket fuel. What you also get, though, is an opportunity to blow yourself to kingdom come, because as I didn't realize, you see, as you compact them down,
right,
they rub against each other, and they generally tend to ignite, ruining great portions of my mother's floor. So I did a lot of that kind of stuff. What did you do?
I did something a little bit different than that. I had
more intelligent, no doubt.
No. Those are what we call basement bombers. That was in the days of how kids were learning to build rockets, and unfortunately some kids lost eyes and fingers and such on that.
Oh, yeah, don't try that at home.
Oh, yeah, please don't do that. It's extremely dangerous. But I was fortunate. I had a big machine shop that I could work with. My dad had retired out from an injury. He worked for a man named Lee Petty, who has a son named Richard Petty, and some parts of the world, like in Southeast America, where we are, those guys are known pretty well. They're famous race car drivers.
Sure.
And my dad was an engine builder for them.
Ah.
So I'd work in the shops, and a shop of that nature is extremely close related to a shop that builds rockets. You have all the machine tools, presses, lathes, you have dynamometers. You have all the instrumentations, calorimeters, everything you need to. Because those shops are built for speed. And even the fuels are the same. For the drag racers, they would have methane, nitro, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen.
Oh, you had it all.
Oh, it was all there. And I'd work during the day and help my dad. And I would, by the time I was 12, I could overhaul a 426 Chrysler Hemi by myself in about 3.5 hours. That's pretty fast.
But, yes.
I got really good at that. And then during the night, the basement bomber was turned loose there, and there was everything I needed, all the machinery, the tools, everything. So I started putting rockets together. And the first one I built was a liquid fuel drive type engine, where I'd use liquid hydrogen and kerosene.
Wow.
Which is very similar to the Saturn V fuels in the moon days. Anyway, the rocket left out of the backyard, and it left at about 3,500 miles an hour. And the way we could clock that was I built a calorimetry device where I could get altitude and altimeter. So by being 500 feet away from the pad, that coastline of tangent of 1 on the trigonometry table, I could multiply the altitude and with a little protractor. You ever seen a protractor that, you know?
Oh, sure.
Okay, you glue that to a board and then screw a little stick through there that has little eyelets, and you look through the eyelets like rifle sights, and you track the rocket and look at the where it stops at the apogee curve, and it would tell you
how fast it got to
right,
where it was going.
Yeah, that would, you backtrack, you find out the, you get the degree off of the protractor, then go to the tangent book and then trigonometry table and backtrack that, use a stopwatch and get that out to a certain time, and that's how I could tell how fast it's going. So I drove about 80,000 feet on the first flight, which is a little bit high.
80,000 feet?
Oh, yeah. And I had a beeper transponder that I had in there so I could track the thing. And
wow.
It came back within about a half mile radius of where I launched it, but the first place of launch was kind of at the very end of the yard, which was toward a cow field, and I incinerated the yard, about size, about quarter size of a football field. It was burnt to the crisp, right down to the roots of the grass. And I turned around and looked at my friends, fellow 12-year-old friends, and we weren't really allowed to play with matches. And here I just threw a fireball about the size of a schoolyard, and I turned around, and they were gone. They were just dust where they were standing. And
80,000 feet, that's a hazard to all navigation.
Well, yeah, but I at least had enough foresight to call Fort Columbus. I was in Ohio at that time, and I could get the flight times, and I knew exactly by the charts that they give you out at FAA flight stations where all the commercial airliners were, and I could time it where I could launch something like that and not poke a hole in one of the wings, which they'd get really upset about that, I would think.
That, or you could have brought down an SR-71 or
no.
a U-2 or something.
This thing, I guess I overdid the fuel part. It had a longer burn time than I was expecting. And
in other words, it was literally still burning when it hit the ground.
It was pretty hot. It finally slowed down, and they had parachute recovery. So when it came in, the thermocouples would detect the heat, cool down, and then I'd time the delay charge to blow the parachutes out, and it just drift right down. You pick it up.
Oh, cool.
So that was my first rocket at age 12, and that started the whole thing, I guess. And I just kept building and getting bigger and bigger. And eventually, my parents moved me away from the house, and was able to strike a deal with four farmers in the area. That all four of the farms come together, and I was right in the center of all the four farms.
So, son, you need your own house. We can't use it.
Well, as a matter of fact, my dad moved me out of the basement the very next day. We overhauled a big garage that was about 1,000 yards from the house. And he told my mother, well, if anything goes bad, he won't launch and blow the house up and take us with it. It'll just be a crater where the shop was, and we'll just erect a stone there.
This a memorial where, there for David.
This is where David Dare once was.
Yeah.
So I had some pretty understanding parents.
You were really doing it the right way. I with my match rockets, they could be very explosive. And I got a rain gutter, and I figured one time to launch from a rain gutter, you know, at an angle. And I put the rain gutter in the crook of a tree.
You're my kind of guy, I'm telling you.
Well, it was a good idea.
Yeah, it was.
Except that it was, unfortunately, it was a bomb. Instead, and when it blew up, it blew the entire tree limb off.
Oh, God. See, the way you're packing those little match heads, you're packing sulfur, nitrate, and with the sulfur, it's a very uneven burn on the BTUs.
Yep.
So what happens is, instead of a slow, steady burn like a solid rocket engine would do, you're getting a rapid burn in a tight area, and what you have is a hand grenade.
That's exactly right.
And
my metal models tend
shrapnel.
To... shrapnel, yes, sir. I don't know how I lived through the experience. I have no idea.
Well, I tell you what, Art, that's... you were destined to do something like that, and you learned from it, and I guess divine intervention came down and said... protected yourself from yourself.
Well, David, I always wanted to fly. Then next thing was hang gliders in Alaska, and I compound fractured my arm in Palmer, Alaska, and that ended my hang glider. Now, you know what I'm thinking of these days? I want an ultralight. I'm going to fly. Somehow or another, I'm going to fly.
My kind of guy.
So, David, we've got a lot to talk about. Stay right where you are. It's the bottom of the hour, and we'll be right back. David Adair is my guest, and just wait till you hear where we're going. I'm Art Bell. This is CBC.
Toll free, west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-825-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. 1-800-825-5033. This is the CBC Radio Network.
I'm Art Bell. Good morning. You know what you're hearing, don't you? Cusco 3, Permac 3. It's Cusco, Permac 3. Return to Native America. This is good, good stuff. Some of you may be able to get it soon. Others have already got it. I'm telling you, it's good music. All right, a couple of quick messages regarding the rogue market. Art Bell, will you also be telling us when the time is right to dump Art Bell stock? Sure, yeah. Sure, if it happens, you know. I'll tell my friends. I've got a fatal disease. Dump now. And another one. Art, I just purchased 95 shares of your stock. Your volume of 516 shares is more than double that of the number two radio host, G. Gordon Liddy, or number three, Dr. Laura. Art, you're killing them. In the time it took me to write this, your volume went from 516 to 596. I'm telling you, get in there and buy now, folks. You're going to make money. Rogue market money. And I'm going to catch and pass Stern and Imus. You watch. You know what I just heard? I heard a rumor that my stock in the next few days might split. So time to get in is now. Of course, that's just a rumor. Now back to David Adair, who is somewhere, I think, in Southern California, right, David?
Yeah, right now I'm in L.A.
L.A. Lucky you. All right, well, so much for our dangerous childhoods, I guess. When you grew up, David, what did you become?
Right now I make a living as a TTC, which is a technology transfer consultant, and what that is, I take space technology that's just designed and used in space.
Sell it to the communist Chinese?
No.
No?
I redesign it and put it into commercial applications.
I see.
That really has nothing to do with space, and people go, well, you know, that's kind of clear as mud, so I can give you an example. In the Apollo days, the astronauts went out to the moon and back. I know some people don't believe that, but they did.
Stay good and close to the phone for me, David.
We don't
have a wonderful connection here. We're going to have a big brouhaha about the moon tomorrow night, whether we went or not.
Right.
What do you think?
We went to the moon.
You think we did?
Well, I'm certain we did, because where I was at the time, I knew Von Braun when I was 12, because of the rockets I was building. Just things evolved and newspaper stories and such, and I got to meet the man.
You met Von Braun?
Oh, yeah, many a time. And when Neil Armstrong was walking on the moon, I was leaning against Viola Armstrong's knees, that's his mother, in her living room, and we were
really?
Watching Neil walk on the moon.
Really?
Yeah. Well, see, I was in Mount Vernon, Ohio, and they lived over in Wapakoneta, and that wasn't far away, and the local congressman who funded a lot of my projects for educational reasons, actually it was political reasons for him, but educational was the label. I got to know a lot of these people, and I made friends with them, and I just stayed friends ever since, all my life.
Wow.
And all that just kind of evolved naturally. By being a technology transfer consultant.
Yeah. Well, everybody has those things. You know, where were you when we took the first step on the moon?
Yeah.
It's well, hard for you to remember, huh?
I was leaning against Viola's knees in her living room, and all the original seven astronauts were on the floor with me.
Watching. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so it's kind of a little different memory for me, I guess.
I guess.
Most people are used to. But, yeah, so when I grew up, I really didn't go into propulsion to, didn't do any more of that work until I was through with the Navy. And I do the transfer now, and I never finished really telling them why I transfer it. When the astronauts went to the moon in the Apollo program, they were eating solid food. and just about 3 days out, 3 days back, 2 days on the moon, so you're looking at about normally an 8-day mission. Well, after about 3 days eating solid food, something's got to give, Art, you know? So, and plus it's weightless up there.
Well, yeah, I thought that was all arranged for.
No, that's about the size of a broom closet. So, there's no bathrooms on Apollo capsules, so they use diapers.
Diapers.
And, diapers, that's all they had.
So, now there's an uncomfortable truth.
Yeah, well, you know, broom closet is weightless, and you don't want anything floating with you.
Oh, no, you don't want floating, no.
No, so well, they made a really interesting material that could absorb nastiness away from you and still kind of keep you dry. So, in transfer, we call Johnson & Johnson, you get the disposable diaper, and that's where it came from.
You're kidding, really?
Yeah, I'm serious. Another little transfer that happened. It started way back in the 60s with the Mercury astronauts. You know, you had an astronaut out there in orbit, and the doctors want to know, I hope he's doing okay up there, so they decided to do something about that, and they hooked sensors to their bodies, and the sensors would pick up the blood pressure, the pulse rate, respiratory function, all the vital signs, and relay it back to ground by telemetry.
Right.
Well, in technology transfer, we'd walk in, look at that, and go, hey, you know what we can do? So now you've had a head-on collision in your local town there. Your neighbors or family members are dying from the impact. The paramedics come rushing up. They open up this little suitcase. They hook these leads to the person. The information is sent to a local hospital. A doctor looks at their blood pressure, the pulse rate, respiratory function, all the vital signs. Tell the paramedic how to stabilize that person, get them to a trauma center, and that's where that suitcase came from.
Hey, you're like the Japanese, then.
We were the original.
Japanese.
That's right, and then they came over and mimicked us, but we still do that. There's been, to date, over 75,000 transfers from the space technology programs into commercial applications. I could take you through a house and take us hours, and I can show you all the stuff.
Well, you know, it's funny. I could use that because a lot of times people call up, and we have debates about whether the space program is worth anything at all.
Oh, in the name of God.
And people say, name something. And, of course, everybody says Teflon.
Okay.
And
the Kevlar. Well, actually, more practical things. Do you have a Makita or a Rockwell cordless drill?
I do.
Guess where that nickel cadding battery is designed. You ever try to stretch an extension cord from here to orbit? Well, we had to create battery packs for power tools, and that's where that came from.
I see.
I could go down the list in the medical arena. It's unreal, the stuff we spun out of there.
Fax machines. I use fax machines a lot.
Well, the cellular technology that you're enjoying today, which affects your pagers, your beepers, even your power books, your... all of that was originally stamped out from the space program, and we were moving through the microcircuitry systems because we had to reduce these huge computer systems. And then we did a sudden jump in a lot of technology, which space program was the first to pick it up in our applications, and we redesigned it. But when we picked it up, it's where we got it from that's real interesting. I think Corso is right on the money.
Well, that's where I was going. I interviewed Corso, as you may know. I don't know whether you heard him, but I interviewed him twice.
Oh, okay.
I had 6 hours of interview with Corso, which is more than anybody else on the planet. He's not doing any interviews right now.
Right.
And it is an amazing, believable, just here it is, folks, here's how it happened story. You buy it, I take it.
Well, I spent about 4 days with the man in Roswell, at the 50th Roswell, New Mexico, at that 50th anniversary.
Right.
Plus, I flew on the plane with him back, and I met him again here just recently. So we've had a lot of time to talk. And what is interesting, in a way, what he was doing created an industry for me that I've made a living for the last 19 years off of.
This transfer.
The transfers, yeah. And there's a lot of strange stuff in that area, the way the technology has made such quantum leaps. You know, we can backtrack certain things in the computer areas where we went from the vacuum tube to the transistor.
Yes.
And then when we jumped from the transistor to the microcircuitry board, that was such a quantum leap. And what's interesting, if you try to backtrack some of this technology, like run through the bibliography of abstracts of NASA's files, you run into the original source and it'll stamp on there unknown, and you... What do you mean, unknown? No, here's the stuff in the field. Don't worry about it. Use it. And I'm going, well, wait a minute, guys. And so a lot of stuff just really just developed and dropped right out of the sky, literally.
Literally.
And we've infused it in our technology. Have you ever looked at the technological rate at which we're moving? It's in an exponential level climb.
Oh, I know.
And, well, there's a reason for it. And the reason it's doing that is that we get this technology. Let's say it's from a really advanced design or something. We've got to reverse the engineering on it. Fine, you've got all this fantastic technology, no infrastructure to support it. An example would be, I'll give you a Ferrari, but I'll put you back in 1865. Well, if you don't have any fuel and there's no gas stations, what good is that car to you? Well, you could tie a horse to it and have it pull it around.
That's about all, though.
That's it. See, and so it's we've had the same structure. This incredible technology drops in. There's no infrastructure to support it. So what has happened, we just got to the point, to the space program, where we had an infrastructure, then we could dump this more superior technology. That builds another base. Then we build up another infrastructure layer on the tier, like a wedding cake, and then we dump another load of technology, and the quantum leap, and infrastructure is built, and just keep going. But we're doing an exponential rate climb, and nobody ever slowed down long enough going, where'd this come from? And so it's real interesting, and I knew for years, for the last 19 years I've worked in it, and I'm just going, man, the quantum leaps we're making is incredible, and if you think we've got something pretty hot right now, you know, give yourself about another 10, 15 years, you don't believe what you're going to be staring at.
What do you see coming?
Well, you'll have very soon, it's only a pencil problem, but we're not far from AIs, artificial intelligence. Once we get the AIs online with computers, they'll become self-aware. Once they become self-aware, then the cycle starts again. First thing they'll probably build is a voice transponder where they can talk to us. Then the next thing they'll want to do is start building themselves, which they can do faster and better than we can. We fall out of the loop at that point.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Is this really such a spiffy idea?
I don't know if it is or not, but I do know this. It's going to happen as sure as you're breathing air, and it's inevitable, and you will not stop it. It's already on a cannonball roll, and it's just a matter
of
time.
The air you just talked about, though, is getting marginal in a lot of places, and if there was a logical artificial intelligence, and I've had this conversation with other people, it might logically, eventually, as a matter of fact, I talked to Charles Osman, who believes there will be AI first, probably in effect, born on the internet.
It's possible. I think it's going to originate out of either the big academia labs like Georgia Tech, where I live, where they're working on the computers for the Star Wars systems.
Right.
And they have to have AI in order to pull the Star Wars systems together to get all the target acquisitions things done. It'll come out of someplace like that, and it will be a remarkable thing when it does. Because once they become self-aware, they'll can build themselves, and you'll see computers jumping to 30, 40 gigahertz speed.
Oh, sure. And they'll begin improving themselves?
Well, eventually what they'll want is a bipedal anthropoid package so they can move around the three-dimensional world that we have built for ourselves. In other words, the android-type body they'll have to have so they could interface with us on a more, interpersonal level.
But I would imagine that something that has intelligence, self-awareness, and would be aware of its surroundings and human beings and what's going on with our ecology and our air and our industrialization and all the rest of it might decide there are too many people and not enough resources and come to conclusions. And then if it had the power to change things, it probably would try to change things.
Well, I totally disagree. It's going to go the other route. A total logic machine that's looking at things, it is illogical to kill and destroy. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, it wouldn't think of it as killing and destroying, though.
Well, that's an assumption we could make at this point. I believe what's going to happen, they'll become a sub-class people in our race, where we have Japanese, Chinese, blacks, Hispanics, AIs, and the become group right in there with the rest of us. And I think they'll have more of a tendency to try to figure out what's going on and figure out the problems. And they probably could ask some really potent questions that'd be very difficult to answer. For instance, why do we spend 75% of our resources in military systems designed to blow ourselves into oblivion? That's not very logical, is it?
Well, no, it isn't. That's where I was going. And
right.
So it would ask the question, and eventually, if an artificial intelligence got control of the web,
mm-hmm.
It literally would have access to and control of all that machinery.
Right.
Let's
well, what's
it.
Happening is you're interjecting your emotions in there, and you're making conclusions and jumping to an assumption, which we haven't been able to prove on either side, that these machines will be hostile or malevolent. I think they're going to be just the opposite. I'm on the positive side of the technology wave. I'm just not going to believe things are going to be, instead of a Terminator machine coming at you, it's going to be a more of a type of machine that can solve a lot of our problems, and it's going to be more probably caring, because the logic will dictate, and pure logic, you just don't kill for the fun of it like we do.
I don't think that pure logic thinks of it as killing them.
No, but it's better to build than destroy. So if you're going to destroy, it would be destroying. If you kill an organism or a plant or any type of life form, that's destructive, and destruction is not logical.
Well, I might argue with you a little bit there. it might be logical if the alternative is complete destruction. In other words,
extermination,
yes.
Right. I just don't think it's going to happen that way. I really don't.
I guess we'll find out, huh?
That's the thing. Only time will show which one of us is right.
All right. Well, back when NASA was launching Challenger, how did you get involved in that?
I was there on the pad when Challenger was being launched, and I was in the area because I was busy working on some programs of my own called GAS, G-A-S, Getaway Specials. That's where you...
Getaway Specials?
Yeah, that's produced out by the Technology Transfer Division of NASA. That's where you can rent this thing that looks like a 55-gallon drum for $3,000, $7,000, or $10,000 if you take the whole drum. You can have it bolted on the inside wall of the cargo bay of the shuttle, and you can run microgravity experiments, and it's available to anybody, private citizens, academia, corporations, whoever, and they already flown 1,500 gas canisters already.
In other words, somebody in private industry who figures the vacuum of space would produce something that would lead to industry and a lot of money.
Well, yeah. Let me show you a good example of TTC. I went to a very large chicken manufacturer as a client, and you tell them, how would you guys, first I asked them, I said, how long does it take a fertilized embryo to go from an embryo to a chick? And they said, well, about 27 days. I said, well, let's rack up a bunch of fertilized eggs and put them in a gas canister, send them up in orbit, and let it run full duration. When it comes back, there's some possibilities we know that we can do already from some previous programs. We can alter DNA while it's being formed up there in the weightless environment. When the RNA factor links are welded together by the enzymes, you can start changing coding. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, chickens are killed by certain chicken diseases here on Earth that cost the poultry industry billions of dollars annual loss. So you bring these chickens back, guess what? They're immune to that disease. You interbreed them with the other chickens, and eventually you got a whole string of chickens that are no longer affected by that disease.
Or the chicken that eats Toledo.
Yeah.
See,
well,
I'm going to be your balancer.
that's not too funny.
I know.
If you could have a chicken to grow up the size of a German Shepherd, maybe have four legs, and you wonder how it tastes, you'll never know because you can't catch it.
Right?
However, on a more serious corporate side, I told him, I said, okay, the chicken could be normal, could be deformed, or we can have a positive DNA change with a good chicken. Or, if nothing else, when you come back home, it's the first high-level multi-organism went full-term in space, and when you come back here, you'll get $1 billion worth of free publicity to the news, and you'll blow Ronald McDonald out of his Chicken McNugget. But, well, they signed before we could even get out the door, and unfortunately, that project was on Challenger.
Space? Oh, my God, it was on Challenger?
Right, and now that's why I was there.
Oh, my goodness. All right. That's why you were there. All right. Fascinating. All right. Hold tight. We're at the top of the hour, and we will be right back. David Adair is my guest. I'm Art Bell. This is CBC.
When I was young, CBC.
Taking calls on the wild card line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First-time callers can reach Art Bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222.
Good morning, everybody. We're talking about space, and we're just getting started. My guest is David Adair. He's a rocket scientist. We'll get back to him in a moment. It says, no, Art, don't do it. Art, rockets that blew up, broken bones, ran gliding, don't try ultralights. Take it from an ex-rocket builder. I used FFG-grade gunpowder, an ex-hang glider pilot. I flew ultralight products in Pacific Windcraft, and ex-ultralight pilot. With your record, Art, you will kill yourself. Have fun, stay away from the trees, and remember, ultralight engines love to quit working at very inappropriate times. Yeah, but I want to fly. Really, really, really want to fly. Here, once again, is David Adair. David, hi.
Hey, Art.
So, you had these chickens that were going to go up on Challenger, and I guess, well, they did. They just never made it to space because Challenger blew up.
Right.
What did you know or think you knew about Challenger, or what concern? How did you cross swords with NASA before the launch?
There was so much stuff going on. It goes on back, at least the part where I was aware of it. It's in my book. They knew about the O-rings failing, at least 9 months before. They had brought the SRBs in, some of the rocket boosters, and they already had burn marks laterally down their sides, and they were already burning through, and they just kept pushing the roulette wheel, and they came up with a black number.
What were they thinking, that it wouldn't burn through the second ring, or...?
Just insanity. The first thing that NASA told Morton Thiokol to do is reduce the weight of the SRBs. Well, how do you do that? Well, let's machine the walls down to half their original thickness. Uh-huh. Let's take out the reinforcement strut, and let's put in a more higher performance propellant. That's so we can get more lift on it, and we can charge... less dollars per pound in payload and be a lot more competitive. Well, it's a phrase, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure this one out. That is a prescription for a sheer disaster. And they went ahead and did all that. And that's one of the reasons, one of the main factors that Morton Thiokol was not sued was because they were following NASA's instructions. And the reason NASA was doing that was because they were under tremendous political pressure. There's too much politics in the program, still way too much. What happened was NASA opened its fat mouth and said that the space shuttle is now operational. That's a lie, just outright lie. That thing will never be an operational vehicle. It will always be an experimental vehicle. You know, we have a Model A going here, and until you get to a Ford or Plymouth, you're not going to have an operational vehicle. You got to go to second and third design generations. That thing's 20 years old. My God, they retired the Enterprise from Captain Kirk when the Enterprise was 20 years old.
That's true.
So they got more sense than a Star Trek movie. But anyhow, they got out on a limb when they said they could compete. We in the private sector and the commercial side of the space program, we were going, they're crazy, they can't possibly do this. The bloated bureaucracy system will drive the cost up too much. They're all constantly cutting back because of budget restraints. They don't have the infrastructure to even compete on the commercial market. But nevertheless, they said they could. So what happened was they started selling the cargo bay out to general general space, commercial space. So here's a scenario how it works. Let's say you're Ted Turner, and you just called me, the director of the space program, and you have crawled up my pants. You are so upset because we're already almost a year behind our flight schedule. Well, guess what? You just paid for a $500 million satellite sitting in a hangar going nowhere, and that's bad enough for you, but it's worse. You're losing millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars a week due to lost subscriptions, due to lost pay-per-view channels, due to the commercials.
Sure.
You're just furious, and you tell me, get that thing up in the air. So,
pressure.
Right, pressure's building. Well, you're not satisfied. I go, I'm doing the best I can. Not good enough. So now you jump to the senators. So you talk to a United States senator on the board of the Senate Subcommittee on Science and Technology, which governs NASA, and you tell the senator, hey, Senator, let me tell you something. Here's what's happening. You know, I've got all these cable subscribers and stuff, and guess what? Every one of them is your constituent and voter. If you want to be in the office next time on term, I suggest you get that satellite up in orbit now. Otherwise, I'm going to do all I can to put money in the other opponent's pocket and bust you out of that seat. Well, now they turn around and jump on you like a vengeance.
Sure.
Okay, so it's cranking up. Now they're really under pressure. They're moving further behind schedule. They're working faster and faster and working those poor workers, which are some of the finest engineers on the planet, which is the workforce of NASA. And now the poor workers down there has a bureaucratic cesspool on top of them that's going nuts. Underneath them, they got a technological nightmare called a space shuttle. That O-ring is what we call a critical item. And when an A-1 critical item fails, you will lose ship and crew. Do you know how many A-1 critical items are on that thing? 250 items. Any one of them fails, and you'll lose ship and crew. How do you like playing Russian roulette in this game with 250 loaded cylinders?
Wow.
Yeah. Welcome to space, 1997.
That must be something sitting up on top of that thing for launch each time.
Oh, it's something to endure. It's a fabulous thing to see.
And I'll tell you something else. Now, I'm only a layman, of course, but I watch the launches. And I could swear, David, that I have seen the same kind of flame in the same kind of place where the Challenger blew up.
You probably did, because I told you earlier, 9 months earlier, I took photos of the daggone SRBs coming in Cape Canaveral, Port Canaveral, being pulled in by the tugs, and they've got splits on their sides. And I knew right then we're in serious trouble. Well, on the morning of the launch, which was January 28, 1986, it was outrageous. It was 28 degrees ambient temp, wind chill 7 on the pad. You got ice hanging on this thing 15 stories high. It looked like Dr. Zhivago, Ice Palace. And I'm going, God's name, you're not going to launch this thing. And so I walked over and talked to some of the tech people. I mean, you guys can't be launching this thing. Look at that thing out there. I said, it says in the manuals of Morton Thiokol, you can't launch a solid rocket booster below 53 degrees Fahrenheit. The O-rings will harden up. You ever jump on an old car seat in like the early 50s and the vinyl would break?
Sure.
Well, that's exactly what happens to them O-rings. So you flip those engines on, and I don't know if you know this, but the solid rocket boosters do not burn from the bottom up like a 4th July rocket. They burn from the top down. The fuel is stacked in there like a stack of donuts, and the center hole is where the fire comes out, so there's a star ring at the top that ignites everything. So it starts from the top down. By the time it gets to the lower sections of the SRB, you're about 74, 75 seconds into flight. The temperature now is over 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than a cutting torch that cuts steel. It goes right out. Oh, by the way, that O-ring.
Yeah.
I forgot to tell you. Remember, we're lightening the load, right?
Right.
We had three O-rings. They took out two sections of the O-rings. Instead of triple redundant, you only have one ring now.
Great.
The fire comes down, and I tell you what happened. There was a black puff of smoke at the 1 second mark when the SRBs ignited. They had already ruptured. The crew's dead. There's nothing you can do for them. You can't throttle down. You can't bail out of a shuttle. They took out all the ejection seats for budget cuts. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. Look, don't believe me. Go check out the Library of Congress. It's all in the records. In the congressional testimonies of Challenger, it's all right there. Wonder why y'all didn't hear about this.
Well, I know that before the Challenger disaster, they were saying the odds of a Challenger disaster, of it blowing up, was about 1 in 100,000.
Who said that? Probably NASA.
NASA.
And
right. then, of course, it had to be revised to 1 in 25.
Yeah. And it's not funny. I lost two friends on that thing. I've known since I was 17 years old. Also, I'm the national spokesperson for the Ron McNair Challenger Foundation in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh.
So I take this personally. Challenger was 10 years and 6 months ago for y'all, 8 months. It's yesterday for me. So it just doesn't end. We never even got our say as to people that what really happened in the Challenger incident. And then NASA's got the gall to come out with a film not too long ago, all the right things they did with Challenger. Hell, they murdered seven people and got away with it. This NASA, NASA, never a straight answer.
So you and Richard Hoagland.
I tell you, well.
You know how he feels about it.
Yeah, I have a problem with Richard. I used to be a big fan of his, and I still am. But he really pulled the plug on something. The man had NASA backed into the ropes better than any prize fighter could do. And I was going, yay, Richard, because in his first tape, he really had them on a spot. They were under pressure. I watched them sweat. That was so much fun. And then Richard kept going on and on with his theories and stuff, and what happened was it started a discreditation in the 3D world, and he gave them an exit ramp, which they took. And
they would look for any little thing to jump on.
Right,
all
they got is, well, see, he really pointed out the face on Mars. He pointed out the Sidonia region, and I'm telling you, that was serious, and he really had them on the run. But when he kept going on with the series, all they had to do was the Senate committee goes, look what else he's saying, you know, all the ancient civilizations, all that stuff. And, you know, right now in the 3D world, we haven't even proved there's micro-life up there. NASA's now recanting their story back on that.
I don't dismiss the possibility there was a civilization at one time on Mars. I think it's distinctly
possible.
It's very
probable, but the problem, the point I'm making here is that
I know,
an exit ramp and they took it. And,
I know.
And he killed the very thing he started. And I'm going, oh, God, no, he had him, you know. And so anyhow, other than that, I don't have any problems with it, but it's... I've been punching at them for so long, and I can't get a hole punched through that wall. It's just so tough. But let me tell you another thing.
All right, but you have been out on your own limbs, David.
Yeah.
I mean, it reads here that you testified in front of Congress April 9th, 1997.
Yeah.
On extraterrestrial intelligence, recovered extraterrestrial hardware, and reverse engineering of downed ET aircraft. You claim you've been at... By the way, I live in Pahrump, Nevada. You know where Pahrump is, right?
No, I don't.
You don't? All right.
No.
It's over the hill from Area 51.
Okay.
It's an area they say doesn't exist, of course. Now, up the street from me, not very far,
okay,
we've got a VFW. And every morning at about 4:30 or 5,
yeah,
they got about five or six buses sitting there at the VFW. And... plastered all over the side of each one of them is Area 51. It says it right there, Area 51. And all the people,
yeah,
you know, a lot of the people live here in Pahrump that,
yeah,
work at Area 51.
Oh, goodness.
And one day I'm going to go up there with a camera and take a picture of that. But I don't really need to because we've got photographs of Area 51. I just got the most remarkable photograph of Area 51.
I'd love to see that.
Oh, it is cool. And it's the best one I've ever seen. I'm waiting for the men in black to come and get me.
Do they show the three hangars? Are the three hangars still there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, it's the center hangar where I had my little ride. And
Wait, let's back up here.
Okay.
How does anybody ever get into Area 51?
It's a long story. You got time?
Well, yeah.
Okay, here we go. You remember I was building all these rockets?
Yes.
Okay, well, the rockets were progressive. They kept getting bigger and bigger, faster and faster.
Sure.
So finally, the mass and stuff I was using started changing one day with me, and I started designing a different type engine. I then really pushed all I could in the liquid fuel area. Solid propellant really was less practical than the liquid fuels in performance. So it's time to take a look at another engine. Well, at that time there was several other alternative engines, but NASA would never even look at them. I don't know why. I guess because Von Braun, he's such a good salesman, he sold the government on liquid fuel technology engines. But this engine I built for my rocket is an electromagnetic confusion containment engine.
Whoa. And what is that?
Why is that? Best way to describe it is like a chunk of the sun inside a magnetic bottle. And at one end, you can punch a hole through it with a type of plasma beam that you can open up the orifice field. And when you do that, you have the power of the sun available at SI, which we call specific impulse.
You're getting ahead of me, David.
Okay.
Is it a fusion reaction?
Right. It's a fusion reaction. You collide with the particles accelerators. You can collide deuterium and tritium together.
And so you get a fusion reaction, and you hold it all
inside.
In a containment with
right.
Electromagnetics?
Right. You use a... Let's back up to the beginning of all this. I started working on this design, and as years went on, I was about 15 years old. When I come to the end of my math capabilities, I just could not extend the algorithms of this thing, which would map out a containment field. And you got to understand, this is 1969.
Right.
There's no laptop, there's no CDs, no hard disk, no CD-ROMs, drives.
Right.
There's no cellular phones, no faxes, no beepers. All I've got is a chalkboard, pencil and paper, and a slide ruler. Handheld calculators didn't come out until about 8-9 years later.
That's right. That's right.
So I am down to bare bum with sticks and stones here, bud. And I've worked math until... I was working something I didn't even know a name for it, really, until later y'all call it quantum mechanics. So in quantum physics area, where I was working in the math area, I just come to the end of my rope. So my science teacher, if you imagine a high school science teacher, got a deal with me. He looked at my math work, and he took it over to some colleagues at Ohio State University. They looked at it, and they're going, God, where'd you get this? It looks like it's from Cambridge. And he goes, no, man, it's from this kid out here in the cow fields. So anyway, they put a stamp on it and mailed it. There's no other way to mail, y'all. So they mailed the thing over to Cambridge, England, to a little guy named Stephen Hawkins. Hawkins takes a look at it, and...
Steve Hawkins.
Yeah, and he finds it interesting, and 3 weeks later, I'm taken to Ohio State during my summer vacation to see some people, and my science teacher takes me there, Morris Martin takes me there, and we get there, and we go in a room. First thing I see is all my math scattered all over the drawing boards, and I kind of get a little upset about that. Who's messing with my work? And I hear this little voice, you know, your work indeed. I go, yeah, and I take a closer look, and I went, oh, somebody else's work. I went, science, you can change that down on the lower end of the board there. And this little guy stands up with a cane. He goes, indeed. And he says, show me. I said, sure, watch this. This is how you can validate this theorem. So I do this, and write this down. And he goes, how do you validate it? And I said, rocket engine. So he went, holy smokes. He said, have a seat. And that was Stephen Hawkins. And he had come to Ohio State for a couple of reasons. He worked with a place called Battelle Memorial. It's a big think tank up there. And this was 1969, or just beginning of it, or no, summer of 69. And we sat there and we talked for a while. So for about 2 days while he was doing some work with Battelle, I spent time with him, and he was a big help in the math area.
I bet.
And see, this is what, 30 years ago?
Sure.
So nobody knew anybody, you know, Hawkins. He was in his early 20s. I mean, he was still a young guy, but we kind of hit it off pretty well. He's a real nice, nice guy. He was even frail then, and he was on a cane. You could tell there's something bothering him. But anyway, the only thing we could come up with after we got through, and he was stuck in the same area I was, we'd both come to the end of our rope in the algorithms, because we needed a very powerful, fast computers, and we had nothing available at the time. So we could only sustain the field maybe for 5 seconds, but let me tell you, 5 seconds is a lifetime in a rocket engine.
5 seconds can be a long time indeed.
It's a lot of big burn time, boy, and that's what we did.
All right, David, the rest of it when we come back. We're at the bottom of the hour, everybody. David Adair is my guest, and we're going to be talking about the other space program as well. From the high desert near Dreamland, this is Coast to Coast AM.
Call Art Bell toll-free, west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. 1-800-825-5033. This is the CBC Radio Network.
Good morning from the high desert. My guest is David Adair. He's a rocket scientist. He'll be back in a moment. Listen. Many months, maybe a year ago, I began to talk to you about the changing weather. I just got a fax from Keith, who's faxed me for a long time, who writes the following. Hey Art, the local ABC Channel 10 here just had the quote, and I'm quoting, doomsday winter forecast for California. This was not your normal story. It was big, bad, and scary. See you on the arc. Keith, there is an El Nino building now that is beginning to bring forecasts of winters and rain, for example, in my area of the Southwest, always my area, right? 300% more than normal. If that happens, Keith's right. Time to start the concrete boats again. Oh well, was fun while it lasted, huh, folks? Okay, back now to David Adair. By the way, David, I'm on this photograph of Area 51 that I'm probably going to go to jail for some. there are three main, it looks like, hangars. Two and then one kind of offset or back from the one in the center.
Right.
The one in the center would appear to be, and I'm only guessing, a little larger than the other two.
It is.
That's the one you're referring to, right?
Right.
All right. So anyway, we'll take it from where we were.
Okay.
There you are with the calculations. You're talking about this new rocket motor.
Right.
And how do you get from there to Area 51?
Okay. Before I continue, I was going to say, you just said something about losing weight. I don't know if you really want to do that, Art, because, see, mass floats better in water, but 300% increase in rain coming your way, you might want to consider that. Anyway.
Well, I was smart enough to build a pretty good place. All the water runs downhill from here, but I know a whole bunch of people down below me.
Yeah.
They should be building quickly.
I think they should pay attention to you. You seem to have a handle on some things.
Well, this is no joke. You know, this this changing climate, this El Nino, the temperatures in the Pacific, even all the way up through the Bering Sea.
Right.
Scary stuff, David.
It's going to get worse.
Yeah.
We'll get off tangent. I'm going to go back.
Let's try. I want to find out how you got to Area 51.
Okay. So with Hawking's help there, now I've got somewhat of a field stabilization for 5 seconds. Let me explain to you what a fusion containment engine can do and why I wanted to go that route. There's only... Hawking was working on black hole theorems.
Right.
And so his math and mine were like parallel. They were kind of like a road going down the road. We're two separate lanes, but we're heading in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
But we have different functions. He was trying to get all the theorems necessary to regulate singularities in the event horizon of a black hole. I'll try to make it more simple, but it's he was trying to prove how the black holes function. I was just wanting to replicate a black hole type field, because see, when a black hole's in space, there's only one thing we know that can swallow the sun, it's gone, we never see it again. What is it?
Black hole?
A black hole. So therefore, if you want to contain the field, that could contain a hydrogen fusion detonation, what is it? What is it going to be? A black hole. So I was just trying to get a shell containment so I could contain this thing. I did it through a tutorial compressor type cone shape in the mass waveform, and that gave me exactly what I was looking for in a containment field. His mass really helped me establish the waveform guides, which was necessary for that field establishment. So that was done, so I started ordering parts, and wasn't long before I had been tapped out my resources for pulling in all the necessary materials. So a local congressman of the area, my local congressman in Ohio at that time, was a man named John Ashbrook. I don't know if you remember the name. He even ran for president in 1972. But
no, I don't.
Anyhow, he's a pretty solid Republican congressman of the area, and he's pretty influential in Congress. And the strange relationship we had, somewhat stressed at times, but he really came across with some major funding. It was huge amount of money, even in those days.
Really?
So he, the reason he funded it was because he called some other people, they looked at what I was doing, they said, fund this kid, and he did.
How old were you then?
I was, at this time, I was 16, about 16, I just turned 16. So I'm building this design and all this stuff, and I think it was, I think Hawkins had a lot to do with it, because he was sold on the idea that this thing could work. So anyway, funding came through. In addition to funding, also authorizations of congressional level came through, because I needed some fuel pellets from Oak Ridge, Tennessee. When that happened, another person showed up at the time on the scene. This guy was a retired general named Curtis LeMay.
Curtis LeMay.
Right. So LeMay...
I served under Curtis LeMay.
Did you really?
Yes.
Well, his parents lived in Mount Vernon, Ohio, where I lived. And you can look up in his Iron Eagle autobiography flipped to the back. You'll see his parents listed there in the dates. And there's a newspaper story done about me and my rocket, and it's Mount Vernon News, and it's the same date. It puts everything together. My mother was an LPN. She was LeMay's caregiver to his parents. It's a small world, isn't it? So the congressman asked LeMay to come in and help on this thing, and LeMay hates retirement. God, he hated that. And he did some consulting work. He just couldn't find things that satisfied him, but
yes.
He came in on his project and looked at it, and apparently the congressman had asked him just to interface this thing and walk it through. And when I met LeMay, that guy scared me to death. He was a big guy. He had a stogie that would go from left to right in his mouth all the time. And once everything was completed and the rocket engine was done,
Where did you build this thing?
The big machine shop that I had.
Okay.
That my dad retired from all the from the racing enterprises.
Okay.
So when he was injured, he retired. We left Charlotte, North Carolina, with Charlotte Motor Speedway, and we moved to Ohio, and we took our big machine shop with us up there.
I see.
So there's the facility, and the technical expertise was pouring through my little head, and the machine expertise was coming through Dad and some other friends. And the funding came from the congressman, and the authorization clearance came from the congressman and LeMay and the Air Force, which primarily really did get involved in this thing pretty heavy. So we ended up going to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, and there they loaded the rocket and me on a C-141 Starlifter, and off we went to White Sands, New Mexico.
Wow.
We get there, and another person that was a significant player in all this was Wernher von Braun, and he was helpful because he was in a lot of technical data. I got a lot, with the funding I got, I could buy off-the-shelf stuff. Which was really nice, state-of-the-art at the time, where I could get the altimeters, I could get the generators, thrust vanes, I could go on and on, just all the stuff that goes inside a rocket. But the difference in this thing was the cyclotron detonator area, which was basically the heart of this engine.
David, how was all this funding managed? Did it just dump into a bank account for you?
No, the way they did it, they ran it under a educational grant, and it would come through, and the congressman's office would handle the disbursements. All I would do is just turn out the requisitions to him, and I would already know where I needed the stuff, so he would work the paperwork through. You know, I'm only 16. I'm not.
Yeah, right. This is an incredible
kid,
story.
For God's sake. I'm not into all this stuff. I'm just trying to build an engine, period.
Oh, okay.
And then the congressman jumped in. He was really helpful in that area. And so he supplied the logistic reports, which I'm sure he was doing that to cover his butt, because he would have to show this eventually, I guess, in some kind of physical report. But I just stayed focused on the engine and the designs and everything. But
so you went to White Sands?
Yeah, we ended up at White Sands. We land there. Von Braun told me be careful of some people I might run into, and he kind of gave me some warning about some planes. And even LeMay stayed back at Wright-Patterson. He told me if be careful. He said, "Boy, you're getting in some very touchy area," and he said you could be in trouble. I said, "What'd I do wrong?" And actually, you did nothing wrong, but it's what you're building that could be a real problem.
Hmm.
So it started getting a little. I could sense something was not right. So I had told my dad previously that he always smoked a pipe, and I said, if anything goes bad and I call you and tell you just light your pipe, take it easy, I want you to burn everything in the shop and lab, everything, tear up the models, the prototypes, just crush nothing left.
Yeah.
So he understood that part. So we end up at White Sands. I get there at White Sands, and it's now June 20th, 1971. And I'm now 17 years old. And we prepped the thing for launching, and the colonel told me that there may be a plane coming in. And he said, if it's a black plane, he said, we may have some interesting people. Well, sure enough, this black DC-9 comes in, and out steps all these people in suits with mirror sunglasses. And and the colonel's going, oh, God, DOD. And I went, what is DOD?
What is DOD, yeah?
Yeah, he says Department of Defense.
Of course.
And this one guy stepped out. He was an older guy, just silver white hair and blue eyes, wearing a little khaki outfit. And I recognized who he was. But Von Braun showed me pictures of this guy before. When
who
we
was talked. He?
Name is Dr. Arthur Rudolph. You ever heard of him?
I've heard the name.
Yeah, you should. He's the senior design chief, chief architect of the Saturn V engines of the Apollo program. And he shows up. I thought that was interesting. So he comes over, and I ask him, hi, what's your name? He gives me a name like Henry Wilkerson, the snow white hair, blue eye guy with a German accent, and his name's Henry. And I'm maybe 17 at the time, but I'm going, there's something wrong with this picture. But I just knew who he was anyhow, so I knew, well, he's not telling me the truth already. So I asked him, what do you do? And he goes, oh, I just go around looking at things for a friend of mine now and then. I thought, oh, God.
Yeah, right.
Right. So
he's
we get over
black
to...
DC-9. We just buzz in. yeah, sure.
Well, I'm 17. I think, yeah, you know, just naive kid here, and I'm just going along with it. I may be 17, but I'm about 45 years old inside. So I'm picking up all these adult innuendos that they're just passing right by me in front of me to one another, and I thought, okay, I'll just be dumb. So anyhow, when he asked, can I see you inside your rocket? I said, sure. So he's on one side of the rocket, I'm on the other. I slide open the panels, and he looks down at the engine. When he's looking down, I lean over right in his ear, and I go, in proportional size, it has 10,000 times the power of your F1 Saturn V engines, Dr. Rudolph. Man, he straightens up real fast. He looks white. And then he gets real angry. And he asks, "Who am I?" I said, "I'm just a kid that builds rockets in Ohio and I launch them in a cow field, you know." So I never really talked to him. The Air Force people went ahead and we started prepping the thing for launch. So the rocket takes its place on a pad about 12 miles away.
Yes.
And it fires up. And Stefan was right about something. He said, "I'm not sure about this power curve." And I went, Mr. Hawkins, I absolutely agree. I'm not sure about this either. Because when the engine took off, it was a little bit more than I was expecting. It left so fast, we didn't see it. Have you ever tried to see a rifle bullet leave a barrel?
No.
Kind of hard.
I have seen slow-mo pictures of rifle bullets leaving muzzles, but I've never seen one. No, of course not. Not at regular
right.
speed.
Well, that's why it's like trying to see this thing.
You're saying it took off that fast?
You can't see it. You never did see it when it leaves.
Straight
it
up?
It left so fast. The blast on that thing was a concussion wave that made it all the way to the bunker where we were. And right at the second of ignition, the flames went to the light of an arc welder. And I knew what happened, boy. The detonation took place, containment fills up, and the desert floor is now staring up an engine at the surface of the sun. So it took off. But these engines run hot. These things run about 100 million degrees centigrade. And any plasma physics set or this type of fusion containment drive will run in those areas of temperature range. So it's pretty bright. So bright you can't even see the exhaust. It's like the sun.
Well, what nozzle would contain such a temperature?
You don't. You extend the field out. You extend the field outside the system. You can do that with a tutorial system. If you look at it, they use that same kind of system on a fusion magnetic containment compressor for a nuclear reactor. That tutorial system compressor works inside the Soviet Union's Tomoka reactor, breeder reactor. We could take hours to explain it to you, but I can extend the field in a certain direction in a cone shape, so it goes right out through the Pacific impulse area. And however, when I did finally catch up with my rocket, the fins at the very idle part, they were just gone. They vaporized in the heat. But
I'm sure.
It left out of there, but before it left, Rudolph insisted that I would change the trajectory coordinates on this thing so it'd come down 656 miles northwest of us, about 120 miles north of Las Vegas in an area called Groom Lake. And that's the only name I ever heard. I never heard of anything Area 51. But they always called it Groom Lake back then.
Well, it's Groom Lake, right.
So Groom Lake...
So this thing was... did it have a guidance system?
Oh, sure.
It had a guidance system. So
courtesy of Von Braun.
So I see. So you, at that point, you'd never heard, you didn't know what Groom Lake was.
No, I didn't know. The only thing I thought was kind of strange, I told him, "Look, I launched out cow fields for the last 5 years. I could bring this thing right down on our little heads. We don't have to walk more than 1,000 yards to pick this thing up. Why are you guys shooting this thing so far out? You know, we're, they said, "Just do it." I said, they got a little bit upset. I went, fine. So I did what they wanted. When it was confirmed it landed there, they said, "Get on the DC-9. And I'm getting on the plane. I go, "You know, this may be stupid on my part, but let me point something out. You got strut and rubber tires under this wing. Do you see them sitting there? We're going to land in a dry lake bed. This thing's going to bury up to its belly." They told me, "Don't worry about it, kid. Get on board." So we get on board. An hour, 40 minutes later, we're there. And sure enough, don't worry about it, twin 10,000-foot runways with interconnecting taxiways and a 42,000-acre Air Force base there, and it's not on any of my maps.
It's not on any maps.
I know, and I'm going, "What is this?" And they said, they wouldn't answer, you know, everybody's quiet. I'm going, "Oh, God, here we go." So we land, and at the very south end of the area is down there below the end of the runways on out a little further. I can see my parachutes of my rocket, and it's just did a nice soft impact.
Wow.
And, so there was sitting there. I thought, well, let's go look at my rocket. I can't wait to see it. You know,
well, of course.
This is exciting. And So I started to walk toward the rocket, and then these guys with these little cute little hats and scarves that they wear grabbed me and threw me in this golf cart-looking thing, and we take off riding, but we head toward these really weird-looking hangars. They're low. They're lower than most hangars, but they're big. They're really deep and wide.
I agree.
And it's got these weird-looking lights on top. Did they show that? There's a real strange-looking lighting system on that thing.
I can make out something, but
it's kind of a rectangular-type light with, like, louvers in it, and it's just really strange-looking lights, and they're all across the roof line of all the hangars, so they could flood that whole apron area up. I just happen to notice things. I guess I'm curious about how do you make these things work, but we went for the center hangar. It's a little bit bigger, and we got inside. It's about the size of 4 football fields. In a square.
Yep.
And we're sitting there, and everything's this empty hangar. And I thought, well, this is cool. This is nice. And they showed me a nice empty hangar. And we're sitting there. Nobody's saying anything. And then these lights come on and start. They look like the old police lights. They call party hats. And they start flashing. And then out of the floor comes all these little chains that make like a guardrail. And they come across the door areas, even the small.
Wait. Out of the floor came what?
Have you ever seen on a carrier when an elevator goes down on a hangar deck, you see these little the chains come up out of the floor?
Yes.
That's what this thing did. So all these things came up, and I thought, I've never seen that before. I'm going, wow, that's neat. I wonder what that's for. But no sooner than that, the whole floor, this giant thing drops out from under us. It's an elevator. And we're going down.
My.
And it's a huge, oh my God, it's the biggest platform I've ever seen. And the first thing I thought of was, man, what in the world are you using taking this thing down? Because you can't use cables or chains, you know, like an elevator. Sure enough, looked over in there, and it's huge worm screws. A worm screw is the thing that turns the lipstick. When women turn their lipstick, get the lipstick come out, that's a worm screw.
All right, hold that thought. Okay. We're at a very critical juncture here, so we'll be back to you after the break. David Adair is my guest. And if you want to know the hangar he's talking about, take a look at the picture. In fact, grab it, the Area 51 picture that I've got up on the web right now, before somebody grabs it from me. You'll see the center hangar he's talking about, right-hand side of the photograph. Absolutely incredible. This is CBC.
Taking calls on the wildcard line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First-time callers can reach Art Bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again, Art Bell.
Once again, here I am. My guest is David Adair, and this is getting absolutely wild. David, as a young child, was a rocket scientist, building rockets. Eventually, he began consulting with Stephen Hawking, people of that caliber, built a rocket engine, a fusion engine, took it to White Sands. I'm going through this very quickly now. Launched from White Sands, it came down in a place known as Groom Lake. His rocket came down in Groom Lake. They put him on a black DC-8, black of course, right? And transported him from White Sands to Groom Lake. David got out of the airplane, tried to go to his rocket, was prevented from doing that, taken to the center hangar at Area 51. The center hangar, the one in the middle. I've got a picture of Area 51 up there for now until they get me. So you go up there and look, and you'll see the center hangar. That's the one he's talking about. big hangar. He'll tell you how big in a moment. Went inside, and the hangar was empty. Suddenly, the floor began to lower, just like that of an aircraft carrier. It was a gigantic elevator, and that's where the story will be picked up in a moment. I just condensed 2 hours. David Adair is a very, very interesting individual. Yes, Area 51. Go take a look at that picture. A couple of announcements. Nice to be on our new affiliate in Tucson, Arizona, which is KNST. KNST in Tucson. They're 790 on the dial, and I suspect you can hear us real well. We'll be here from 10 to 3. That is the full show, Tucson. So you ought to call them up and thank them. In this photograph of Area 51, you can tell the person was hiding behind a rock that took it. You can't get that close anymore to get this kind of photograph. That's up on my website. Also, I want to say, go buy Art Bell stock in the Rogue Market. You'll see it right there under the new items. Click on it. It'll take you over to the Rogue Market. Answer their little questionnaire, and they'll give you 10,000 Rogue dollars. Answer more, and they'll give you 15,000 Rogue dollars. Buy Art Bell stock, because Art Bell's trying to catch up and pass certain other people in the talk radio area. You'll see when you get there. Bye, bye, bye. All right, this is an incredible story. Absolutely an incredible story. But you know, David Adair testified under oath in front of Congress, April 9th, 1997, about what I guess you're about to hear. So remember that. He testified under oath to Congress. David, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, so here you are in this middle hangar, and the floor starts dropping.
I was going to mention before we get started. Yeah, absolutely right. This is a story that I told Congress, and I'm under oath. I'm facing 20-year federal prison for perjury if I lie. And they assigned a little task force of their own to do paper trails, and I'm off the hook.
Who called you to testify in front of Congress?
Dr. Stephen Greer.
Dr. Stephen? Oh, of course, Dr. Greer. I've right. interviewed Dr. Greer many times.
Yeah, Steve got, he really put a bait out there I went for, and because it's just possible that we might get a disclosure on information, and that's why for 27 and a half years I did not tell a single human being.
I understand. Nope, I understand. All right, let's continue with the story.
Okay.
So the floor is dropping in this hangar.
Right. It went down, and I was looking at the worm screws. They're huge. They must be about, in diameter, they've got to be the size of a semi in diameter. And they're giant. There's 12 of them. And they're lowering this floor down, and we're going down rather quickly. And the floor must weigh hundreds of tons. And the worm screws can carry tremendous loads. So whatever they roll out on this thing is pretty heavy. So we go down, I guess, about... Oh, it must be about 200 feet.
Wow.
And so we get down, and boy, the floor flushes out. With, and there's this hangar bay down there. It is so huge. It's like a rainbow roof design. But the walls kind of, they don't really curve. They taper at a like an oblique angle.
Yeah.
And all the labs and the shops and the work bays are built into the mountain underneath, so the center bays are open and they're not obstructed by anything. It's huge.
It sounds just like ID4. Day. Independence
Day. Oh, okay.
Day. Remember when they took the president and so forth and everybody went into Area 51?
Right. Whoever did that movie, they got somebody come out to talk, because some of the stuff was correct right down to the door handles, the way it looked. But the lighting, they kind of missed the light. The lighting was really neat. This was in kind of a iridescent, indirect lighting. I really couldn't see where the light sources were, except it was just like panels throughout the entire roof system. But we went down this huge bay. It just stretched, looked like forever. And you could park three or four, you could park about half a dozen 747s down there, not be in the way of anything. I mean, this thing's just huge. And we were in a golf cart, and once we got flushed out with floor, we took off, and we went down to there, and we were just going down through hangar area.
Yes.
And all the workshop bays doors were closed when I was going through there. So I really didn't see anything other than a couple of interesting aircraft. I did see an SR-71 sitting there. The XB-70 was there. Do you remember that?
Yes.
There was two of them built. One crashed. The other one now is in the museum in Wright-Patterson. It was, this one was, one of them was sitting there. There was a couple other experimental aircraft I just didn't recognize. They looked like a teardrop. And the front blunt part of the teardrop would be the forward section that would be moving forward through the air. And I've never really seen anything quite like that since. But we went on down through there, and when we got to this one big set of doors, it's like a work bay area, they got out and turned the dials, and the thing unlocked, and the doors slid open. And I thought, well, this is going to be interesting. I guess whatever it is they want to show me, it's in here.
Yes.
So we get in, and as soon as the doors open, the lights came on automatically. Nobody had to turn any switches on. And it's the way that room was lit that was really interesting. The lights were the entire length of the room, and they went into a rainbow, rainbow-type arc. Best way to describe that, something you can relate to, a paint booth that you paint cars in.
Right.
There are no shadows cast. See, in a paint booth, if you're painting a car and you got a shadow, you could get a run in the paint and not see it.
Right.
This room was lit the same way. There was no shadows anywhere on the floor. And I thought, boy, that's interesting. And so anyhow, there was this big thing, whatever it was, sitting on a huge platform-type table. And it looked to be about the size of a, under the tarps, about the size of a school bus or a Greyhound. And they pulled the tarps back, and my engine is about the size of a football in my rocket.
Yeah.
When they pulled these tarps back, here sits a thing that's a twin of my engine, but it's the size of a school bus. It's an engine.
Oh, my.
And I'm going, holy cow,
yep.
Man. And I was kind of definitely impressed and kind of disappointed. I thought I would had an edge on this engine, but obviously I didn't. And they pulled it all back, and they asked me to take a look at it. And I went, God, this is fantastic. Look at the size of this thing. So they said, yeah, we got some problems with it, didn't we? Wonder if you could give us some clues on some things. And I started thinking, well, you know, is this your engine? They go, oh, yeah, our people have been working on it, but the people's working on it are somewhere else right now, and we'd just like to have your input. And I'm going, something's wrong with this picture. So I went, okay. So I asked him, I said, you know, we're getting ready to launch Apollo 14 at this time. This is June 20th, 1971. And I'm going, why is the Kate using liquid fuel engine when you guys got this thing? They said, well, we're still got some problems with it. And they said, you do want to help your country, don't you, son? And I went, yes, sir, I do. You know, I listened to Anita Bryant. And I just played, you know, okay, yes, sir, I'd be glad to help my country. So they said, fine, why don't you take a look at this thing? And I walked away, and, you know, yeah, you lying. No. So I get to the engine, and the first thing I noticed is really strange is there's a shadow in the engine. Now, there's no shadows on the floors anywhere, so how can we get a shadow on the engine?
Yeah.
And it's a silhouette of me, so I back away from it, it dissipates. I get up closer, and it gets very defined. I thought, well, that's interesting. So I reach out, and I told the guy, I said, I need to crawl up on this thing, take a look at it. He said, fine, but be careful. So anyway, I put my hands on this thing, and there's these outer panels, which I guess they're like cooling baffles. The configuration of this thing is so different. Let me try to explain it. It's if my engine is the old rear-driven engine car from Detroit,
yes.
Okay, that's a power plant, and you see where the powertrain is. The new cars are side-driven, and the powertrain flow is different. They both are engines, but the powertrain flows are different. That was our differences in our engines. Their power flow was completely different the way they rounded the plasma drives. So anyway, when I put my hand on these panels, which were almost translucent, the minute my hands went against the metal, you could see through these panels somewhat, You could see this real neat energy type swirls coming off wherever my skin was touching it, going out through the metal.
Wow.
So I pull my hands back and I go, it stopped. And I put my hands back on it and you see the swirls again. I thought, wow, heat recognition alloy. Gosh, I didn't know we even had that. Well, I don't think we did. So anyhow.
In other words, you think you were staring at something not of our technology at all.
I already knew before I even got up to it, this thing is just, it's not ours, it's not theirs, meaning Soviets, it's something else. And they're not telling me the whole story on any of this. So.
And you were there because you had built something
that's almost
similar,
like a baby twin of it.
A baby twin. And so I now understand why you were at Area 51.
Now you know why they routed my rocket there. Because
yeah.
Now they have my rocket and me on that base. And it's not good for the camper right now because I'm crawled up on top of this thing and I see what the problem is. Once I get up on top of the engine, start walking down it, which, I mean, it's a rush. I mean, you build something that's almost like it, but it's only the size of a football. Now you're walking, on this, on the same design. Yeah, it was just, I mean, you just had to be there to appreciate this, but right in the center. See, our power flows run like an infinity circle. We build the power flows in an infinity design. That's how I can get a gravitron field to stabilize and then hold the containment field. Right where the figure eight crosses each other in the center, a good description, somebody once said it's like the eye of the hurricane, and it is. That's where the main core drives are, and this thing had a core breach. It dropped its field, and the alloy of this engine is now exposed to 100 million degrees centigrade. It vaporizes everything. The blast is going outward, but the fail-safe system of this design is when that thing field goes down, it shuts its own power off in a nanosecond, in a billionth of a second. So imagine an explosion starting, but it implodes on itself to snuff itself out.
So it's like a pulse.
Exactly. That's real good, Art. And so anyhow, it takes this pulse and it stops. It just shuts itself off. And so the blast only went out about 4 feet in diameter, vaporizing everything in its path as it's blowing outward, but it stops. So there's this 4-foot diameter hole, you know, in the center of this engine. I yelled down to them, hey, this thing's had a core breach. And I said, the containment fields went down. And they went, well, what kind of containment fields? I said, well, it's the graviton field of the electromagnetic generators. And they're looking at me, and I'm going, you know, I'm going, this is not their engine. So I looked at it a little bit closer, and I told them, boy, I said, the firing controls, there's no circuitry on this thing. They go, yeah, you want to explain that to us? And that's when I looked at the thing for a minute, and there is no wiring on this engine. I had almost 5 miles of wiring on my football size engine because there's so much I had to contain in the control circuitry. This thing doesn't have any.
Okay.
The reason it doesn't have any, there's something strange, though, that's all over it. It looks like there's these little tubes, like fiber tubes, but they got a liquid in them. They're cascading all over this thing, and right at the very top of it is a big center trunk. And I'm going, this looks real familiar. I said, I know this pattern. It's a brain stem and the cascading fiber nerves coming off of it. All the tubing looks like a big brainwave pattern. And I went, that's the circuitry. So I started to turn around and tell them something. And I told them, they started asking basic, fundamental questions. Finally, I just had enough, and I said, we have an expression back where I come from in the South. This thing ain't from around the neighborhood, is it, boys? And they're looking at each other, and I went, let's do some assumptions. This is an engine. It come out of a craft. Where's the craft? If it's got a craft, where are the occupants? God knows what you did with those folks. And so they got angry, and the two guys have been pulling me around like a puppet and are heading up there to pull me off of it. Now, I said, I'm getting down. So I get down, and right where I'm getting off, I'm really angry at this time, and my hands are on those translucent panels. It's not the nice little swirls anymore. You know what it is?
Hold it. Okay. Hold it. This is where we hang them up.
Okay.
Man, this is some kind of story. My guest is David Adair. He's in Area 51. You're with him right now. And I have no idea what comes next. None at all. Absolutely incredible. I'm Art Bell from the high desert near Dreamland. This is Coast to Coast AM. Great to be with you. More to come. Don't budge.
Toll free, west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. 1-800-825-5033. This is the CBC Radio Network.
It is indeed, and we've got David Adair here, and this is every bit as good as Independence Day. Holy mackerel. Did I manage to leave you at a hang point or what? I just got a fax. Art, CBS is going to do a story about the creator of the Beijing radio on Wednesday's 6 o'clock news. Really? I'm not surprised. The Beijing is revolutionary. If you want one, they're going very quickly. Bob Crane is the only guy who's got them. The number is 1-800-522-8863. Or wait and see it on CBS. Of course, then probably they'll all be sold out. The hangar we're talking about is in the picture of Area 51 that's on my website right now. It's the middle hangar that you're hearing about. Back now, I wouldn't stop this story for all the tea in China, to David Adair. My. Pick it up right where you left off. There you are.
I was getting down off the engine, and this time when I put my hands on the panel, I'm really angry with the situation because I'm just realizing a lot of things at one whack is that here's a technology that is so advanced and it's being kept secret. Nobody has that right to lock this kind of knowledge up from everybody. I mean, my God.
Well, I guess that was part of it, though. Was it, at that point, usable knowledge?
I don't care if it's sitting there broken. It's still an amazing thing to look at. And
sure.
It validates we're not alone. And here they're lying. So I'm just really disappointed. You know, I really was, love the country and the people. Boy, I'm not happy with the government at this moment. So getting down off the engine, I'm really upset. And when I put my hands back in the same area where the nice little swirls were,
yeah.
Now they look like a hurricane or a tornado ripping through the alloy.
Wow.
And I'm going, it hit me right then. I went, oh, God, it's not heat-sensitive alloy. It's picking up something else. It's picking up mental waves. This engine is a symbiotic engine.
It was responding to what you were thinking.
It's a symbiotic engine.
Ooh.
And I just realized, oh, God, this thing is a symbiotic engine. I thought, my Lord, I knew right then, this is not ours. And so what the firing order is on that? The way it works, when a pilot straps into this thing, or a crew member, or even if there is a crew member, this thing could be an ascension entity of its own. A pilot or crew would strap in, and their mental waves would blend with this engine, and that is the firing circuit. That's why they couldn't find any firing circuits on the thing. The crew walking around is the firing circuit. They're like the spark plug wires of an engine.
I understand.
And I'm going, my God, the pilot and crew merge with the ship. And aerodynamic engineering, that's our wet dream, because it would be unreal to be able to achieve that technology.
Actually, even back in the conventional world, they're really working on that now, aren't they?
Yeah, that's when I told Congress. I said, hard to believe? I said, well, let me enlighten you boys about something. I said, let me bring you up to current events. Princeton University, you ever heard of them? They've got a department there being built with a guy named Dr. Bob John. And he's got a contract from McDonnell Douglas. You ever heard of those people? Well, guess what they're doing? They're building a symbiotic screening system to do the opposite, to keep the pilot thoughts out of the F-22 fighter, our most advanced fighter on the line right now. Let me explain what all that means. A pilot comes home, catches his wife in bed with somebody else, and he's having a really bad day, okay?
Yeah.
He's got to get up in the morning and go fly this fighter, so he gets in the fighter, he straps in. This thing is so sensitive, state-of-the-art firing acquisition controls and navigation of black boxes, it can actually sense what he's feeling. All right, you're now engaged in an enemy for us. It's something coming at us. You go into a 1,600-mile-an-hour dogfight. If you hesitate on locking controls, 0.5 seconds will determine whether you live or die. And he's having a bad day. He's thinking about what he just saw, you know, when he came home. The controls sense that, they stutter for a second, and he dies.
Yeah.
They are building a system to prevent that. Wonder where they got the idea, y'all. So symbiotic systems are a way that's the way we want to go in flight aerodynamics and technology, because it's the ultimate systems. Also, it'd be for anything, any computers, your car.
Of course.
It could be applied to so many things, but here I am standing June 20th, 1971, and I'm looking at this thing, and I'm going, gosh, it's a symbiotic engine. So they throw me in the golf cart, and we leave. They lock up the doors, and we're going up the elevator, and things just go from bad to worse at this moment. Because I hear them talking, they're all upset. They go, well, he's not helping us right now. He sounds like he's not the player. They think I'm not listening. And I'm thinking about what I just saw. But I hear them say a term. It's the first time I ever heard it. And it was years later before the public heard it. It's called, we need first strike. You know, what's happening at that moment with America? We just bombed the daylights out of Cambodia. They're not even warring with us. We're up to our eyeballs in war with Vietnam. General Westmoreland's just asked for surgical nuclear strikes, okay, because he's getting his butt kicked all over the battlefield. So if he does that, the Soviet Union has been supplying weapons into Cambodia, and we just bombed it. That's got them upset. They said that if Westmoreland fires one nuclear weapon, they will go full global counter-thermal nuclear war on the planet. Believe me, the Kremlin at that moment was not bluffing. And neither was our people in the Pentagon. The only reason they didn't go at each other is because of the MAD program, M-A-D, Mutual Assured Destruction.
Right.
Well, the only way to win MAD is whoever gets the first strike. So you take this rocket engine of mine, load warheads on it, put it in a submarine, park it off Siberia, and the only thing the Soviets will see is white flashes, not even a blip on the screen. They can't retaliate. They're gone. So you'll take out the key military bases and population centers, and you've done killed about 500 million people in one day.
Good
you
Lord.
Also have to go over and kill somebody else same day, China. So I'm sitting there going, about 2 billion would die in this conflict if they go for a strike. And I can't do this. So I have to destroy my engine. And that's exactly what I did.
You destroyed your engine.
Yeah, we went upstairs, we got to the hangar bay, and when we pulled out, golf cart thing, and Rudolph was there, Dr. Rudolph, and I just started slobbering and boohooing, and I'm really upset. I said, I want to see my rocket. You guys going to take my rocket away from me? I hadn't even got to see it. I mean, I worked so hard, you know, I'm crying. And so Rudolph tells the two sergeants, take him down and see that rocket. So just get me out of the way. So I'm leaning against the hangar door. I reach down, and I put my palm on the wheel of the hangar door. Do you know what's on that wheel? Graphite grease.
Graphite grease?
Yeah. So I put some graphite grease in the palm of my hand. They take me down to see my rocket. I get down there to see the rocket. I slide open the door. I tell the guys, let me check this thing for a fuel leak. So I was checking it, and what I actually did, I reached in, I put my hand smeared across the particle accelerator chambers and closed the door and set the particle accelerators into engagement. Ask any physicist what happens when deuterium meets graphite. horrendous chain reaction implosions will take place. So I got 60 seconds before engagement of the accelerators, and I just run over to the guard. This thing's got a fuel leak. It's going to explode. We got to run for it. We get in the golf cart. We're taking off. And they go, how far do we need to get away? I said, I don't know. And I really didn't. Well, we get about a quarter mile away, and it goes off, and it blows a hole about the size of a football field. There's nothing left. And this limb was gone. So that's so frustrating because, you know, this engine, it has a lot more art than just being a rocket engine. Let me explain what this thing is doing. It's not designed to be launched from Earth to space. It's designed to be launched from Earth orbit into space because it's a principle that we use in Newtonian laws. For every action, there's an opposite equal reaction in space.
Absolutely.
All right, so the matter of a fusion reaction is coming out this same specific impulse, its orifice. It's how fast the matter moving in a hydrogen reaction. 186,756.54 miles per second, called speed of light. In just a couple minutes, that shift will equal the velocity of the exiting thrust, which means we have light speed capability, June 20th, 1971. Huh. So piston is gone, and we get back up to the hangar. Rudolph asks what happened. The guard said, well, he said there was a fuel leak. Well, Rudolph just walked, show you how sharp he is. He walks over and looks at me. He's looking at me real close, and he grabs my hand and looks at it and sees the grease. He knows. And I went, oh. Rudolph looks me right in the eyes, cold blue eyes, and he goes, you will be here for the rest of your natural life. Lock him up. And they did.
They locked you up?
They locked me up.
Jail at Area 51.
That's right. And let me tell you something about little Mr. Rudolph. Check your history on this guy. On May 24th, 1985, he was deported back to Munich, Germany, although he carried the Distinguished Service Medal from NASA, the highest award given.
Yeah, that's true.
The Mossad put him away where he rotted and died over there because that man killed 100,000 Czechoslovakian Jews while they were building the B-2s and Metalworks. He was a Gestapo officer.
All right, I've got one challenge to you on Arthur Rudolph.
All right.
Did I hear your guest say that Dr. Arthur Rudolph, the Saturn V program manager, mm-hmm. had wavy silver hair?
Mm-hmm.
That's rather interesting, since Arthur Rudolph was bald as a billiard.
Right. It was very, it looked like a little pigeon-type thing, except on the sides. It was white. And you got to remember, this was, when did you see his picture? When was it taken?
Well, that's a good point. I don't know. This is a faxer.
Okay. Well, listen at this. It is 30 years ago. Unless you've seen a photo of him recently, he's bald as I am. But in 1971, the old boy had some hair. And it's white. Check it out. So anyway, that's what happened to Mr. Rudolph.
So anyway, they threw you in jail. Now, you're in jail. I mean, a real jail, or what was
it?
Well,
just a room with no windows and just a door. And I'm sitting there, and I'm there for hours. And then finally, there's a big commotion in the hallway. I don't know how I was there. I guess I was there probably 6-7 hours, maybe 8.
Yeah.
Finally, it's ruckus out in the hallway. Door opens up, and it is a big silhouette of a guy with a stogie in his mouth.
Yeah.
Named Curtis LeMay. LeMay came from Wright Patterson Air Force Base. When he lost track of me in White Sands, he then figured out, he pressed some people and found out where the rocket was downloaded at. So he shows up there, and if it wasn't for LeMay, I would still be probably in the Independence Day movie with Bruce Spinner.
Uh-huh.
You know, if we don't get out much around here, that was a really uncomfortable statement for me. I could have been...
How did you get out? I mean,
LeMay took me home. You got to understand where LeMay's at. He's a former head of SAC, Strategic Air Command.
That's right.
And had so from Wright-Patterson, it has jurisdiction over Groom Lake. And he put everybody in their positions before he left. So he may be a civilian at that moment, but it's still a four-star general that's really pissed off at this moment. So he's coming in there ranting and raving, and he's just pushing colonels physically out of the way. Get out of the way. And so he puts me on his jet, and we go home. Once we get back to Wright Patterson, he drives me with his driver all the way back to my house in Mount Vernon, Ohio, where his parents are, and my parents. And he told me, boy, if you want to have any normal life, you have got to not build another rocket. And I haven't.
And you haven't to date?
No.
But you went in front of Congress.
Right.
And told this story.
Absolutely.
David, I'm curious. What kind of reaction did you get when you told this story?
Well, one of the senators came up to me and said, in the name of God, which one of these things do we tackle first? Let's see, you're standing on top of an alien engine inside an Air Force base that doesn't exist, and with a twin engine that you built that matches the alien craft engine. I went, yeah, it's three different ones. Which one do you want to pick and work on first, pal? You know, I personally don't care whether people believe me or not. I lived it. I know it. And there's a paper trail that satisfied Congress, and here I am.
Well, the only thing I know for sure is they're lying their butts off about Area 51.
Right.
There's a photograph. I've got it.
Right.
So they're lying about that. There's no question.
Yeah.
Everybody, I think, agrees and knows they're lying. But this tale you have just told, this story,
mm-hmm.
that you gave in sworn testimony in front of Congress,
right.
is the wildest thing I've ever heard. It's
it was a calculated risk on my part, because they had me hanging in the wind, because they could easily say we can't prove any of this, or if they didn't want to or didn't check it out thorough enough, you know, that could come up with a dozen reasons why, and I would be indicted now.
Yeah, indicted, indeed. Has anybody, now that you're public, since you went in front of Congress, now
right.
that you're telling the story, has anybody come to you? Have there been threats?
Not a single threat, nothing. I haven't had one threat. I'm not being observed, not being tracked. I never bought into paranoia crap anyhow, and gloom and doom and all this despair and conspiracy and stuff. I don't think it's happening.
What do you mean
y'all?
You don't buy into it? You walked into one of the biggest ones.
Okay.
You might as well be Mel Gibson.
I know. I don't think, no. I was born in West Virginia. I'm a hillbilly, for God's sake. But no hero anything here. It's just common human nature. We always are so quick to assume that it's just evil, and they plot and they conspire. You know, they're human beings. They make mistakes. And they're trying to deal with a very difficult problem and a PR nightmare. And they're trying to figure a way to get out of this thing. And the walls are still closing in. And it's like I asked one congressman, I said, you know, I've never seen Congress and the senators so anxious about this. You're squirming like worms out there when I'm telling you the story. I got a feeling somebody's coming to dinner. It's not Sidney Poitier, right? I said, are you guys looking for a welcome wagon hostess? You know. I think there's something happening. They're being pressed by something, and they've got bigger fish to fry than me.
Well, I'll tell you this, and I was told this by a television reporter in Honolulu. I'm going to be interviewing Story. I talked to Story Musgrave here not long ago.
Oh, yeah.
Apollo astronaut.
Mm-hmm.
He gave a presentation in Honolulu, David, and at the end of the presentation, he put up a picture of an alien gray. And I guess without cracking a smile, he said to everybody there, these guys are real. That's what he said.
See,
these guys are real. He wasn't kidding.
I've never seen an alien. I've never seen a gray. I have never seen a UFO, you know, one flying around. I've never seen a spacecraft. All I had, I never worked at Area 51. This is a one-day event in my life that happened 27 and a half years ago.
Have you heard the name Bob? Of course you have, Bob Lazar.
Yeah, and I tell you what. That guy, he's the best articulator of physics I have ever heard. And
you buy a story?
I would really cut him some slack, and I would, because of his ability to understand physics and articulate it. He really knows this stuff. And I hadn't got all of his story, but I've heard some really interesting stuff and little cute things like he called a sports model. And that
sport
kind
of model of saucer, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All in the same place you were in.
Right. You know, I'm sitting there. I am not going to be throwing any rocks at anybody. If you live in a glass house, you don't throw rocks. So, I don't know. If whatever he'd say, from what I've seen, man's probably telling you the truth. But I do know he's no dummy. He really knows his physics. The only crime I see he's committed is he's not a physics teacher somewhere. So, boy, he can really do a good job on that.
I know.
And I wish he'd become a teacher. He is a good one. But No, I would lead to believe everything that Bob is saying at this moment. You know, and
so you think there is an entirely second level space program, all black?
You know, that's really difficult for me to buy, but then I look back at what I stumbled across, and I don't know what to think anymore. In order for them to do that, they can't use any conventional engines. You can't be using liquid fuel or solid. You see these things, my God, 20, you know, two states away, you can see a plume of these rockets taking off out of the Cape. So if they are going to come and going, they got to be having an entirely different type of technology. It's very possible they back engineered this thing. I looked at it long enough. You understand they've had 27 years to work on it. They could very well have developed engines like that. And boy, that really hurts. If it's like I'm working with sticks and stones out here, and you got a big state-of-the-art machine shop. You know, that's the way it would be happening. The rest of us are fumbling around with liquid fuel technology engines, and here they've got stuff light speed capable engines. I mean, that's really not right.
All right, David, we're at the top of the hour. When we come back, I would love to let the audience ask you some questions. It's
okay.
About time for that. I mean, that's a most incredible story. Absolutely incredible.
Well, I've lived it, so it doesn't seem that big a deal to me.
Well, it does to me. Hold on, and we'll let the audience ask questions. Holy mackerel. Independence Day Times, too. We'll be right back.
Pretty woman, walking down the street. Pretty woman, the kind I like to meet. Pretty woman, I don't believe you. You're not the truth. No one could look as good as you.
Mercy.
Pretty woman, won't you pardon me? Pretty woman, I couldn't help but see.
Art Bell is taking calls on the wildcard line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First-time callers can reach Art Bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again, Art Bell.
Good morning. My guest is David Adair. An old man. What a story. What a story. But you know what? You've got to remember, it passed Stephen Greer's test. And you've got to remember, Stephen Greer had this man testify in front of Congress. Let me read you a couple of faxes from Dick in Hawaii. Symbiotic engine? That's exactly what Colonel Corso described. This is all being verified now as different sources begin to fill in the gaps. From Stan Deo in Perth, Australia. Stan Perth. Listening to David Adair right now, Art, I'm aware of at least, we cover a lot of ground here, I'm aware of at least one public patent covering the Mobius strip plasma core containment concept. It also utilizes a mirror field generated by induction from the spinning plasma in the core. Also, David, the lighting was probably a high-frequency one, much like the plasma globes sold in stores. The Tesla radiated field can induce nitrogen to ionized levels, which would give light from all angles. Ergo, no shadows until you get too close to an object. That's why your hand made patterns on the engine's surface. It was an HF field, I am sure, even if it was a symbiotic engine. Regards, Stan in Perth, Australia. So Stan is verifying, as indeed possible, a lot of this. David Adair and you and your questions shortly. Back now to David Adair. And David, it's a split mix on the faxes I'm getting. Some people think you totally flipped out.
Well,
other people think you're absolutely genuine, particularly Stan Deo down in Australia just faxed me, and he is convinced that what you're saying sounds just about right. So are others.
Well, like I said, I really didn't testify for the public on this. I testified for the Senate and Congress, and I let them make their decisions. How many people out there are willing to stand up and put their hand on the Bible and testify of 20-year federal prison staring at them? If you think I'm lying, consider the odds I'm playing.
Yeah, I hear you.
And I don't know anybody else in the UFO community that's done that. And at that point, I am not a UFOologist or researcher or whatever that is. I haven't even seen one of those things. I work in the hard science world. That's where I've been for the last 20 years. And the only thing I've observed about the UFO community, why do they do so much infighting on each other?
I know. Believe me, I know. Let's
go
to the phone.
Logical.
Yep, let's see what we get here. First time caller line, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Where are you? Where are you?
I'm in West Lafayette, Indiana, Purdue University.
Okay.
David?
Yes, sir.
When I was 17 and 18, I won two major awards. One from the Navy, Navy Science Cruiser Award in 68.
All right.
At Regional Science Fair for a containment of a fusion using instead of just the magnetic bottles that were around at the time.
All right.
Using shockwaves.
Oh, that's neat.
And I worked with a professor, with a doctor, was a research at Standard Oil of Indiana.
Oh, gosh.
The research lab was in Whiting, Indiana at the time. Dr. R.E. Probst, he was working only as a front for Standard Oil to exchange business, to exchange industrial secrets. He was German. He worked on an atomic bomb.
Sounds familiar.
And he's deceased since March of 83. But he and I worked very closely. He secured patents, international patents, in German for me, and we worked on this project from 1967, 68 through 69. I know what you went through. I never got as far as you got.
So you believe him, caller?
Oh, I believe him. You know why I believe him? His conscience. He destroyed the machine. I know how interested the military was, because that's who gave me my award. The Navy. Vietnam was going on April 1968. Here, I'm all over all the major newspapers from Chicago to Gary, Indiana. With a naval officer awarding the biggest award I could win in a Calumet Regional Science Fair. And I'm way ahead of them. They don't know what I'm talking about. They know they can get electricity power from this. But I also knew at the very time that the Soviets had used my same spherical device to detonate a clean thermonuclear explosion.
All right, listen, we're about out of time. Any questions?
David?
Yes.
How is your life at this very moment?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. After all of that, now here you are, an adult, David.
Right.
How is your life?
Actually, it's pretty successful in the 3D world. I work as a technology transfer consultant and have for the last 20 years. And on a couple homes, I've done well. And I've never, ever had an incident with the military or the government or anything after that. It's like, sometimes it's like a dream. You just store it away and forget about it. One thing that is parallel with you and I, the Air Force in 1971 gave me the most outstanding field of engineering sciences from the Air Force, and I won that in 1971. You can check that out. That's interesting. You and I kind of run the same parallel in those areas in the science fairs. And I went to the national and international arena with that rocket.
Well, you're blowing a lot of people away this morning, I'll tell you that. Wild card line, you're on the air with David Adair. Good morning.
Hey, my name is Jim from Los Altos near the Santa Cruz Mountains area.
Yes, sir.
I'm actually from near the Fidget Man. I can really identify with that guy. But I wanted to talk with your guest, David, about a real specific part of artificial intelligence and AI that he talked about.
All right.
Give me just a second here. He said something that led me to believe that he recognizes an existing artificial intelligence. Now, personally, I've always thought AI is about 20 years away.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked to some people at UC Santa Cruz who are kind of on the leading edge of this. But if you can give some examples of where AI is really used today, I've read a lot of science fiction about it,
right.
But I'd like to see where it is today.
No, I don't know of any AIs that exist right now.
Well, I think maybe Visa uses it to make credit applications, but go ahead.
The closest thing I know of is Georgia Tech doing the Star Wars defense mechanisms in their computer acquisition. They're pushing harder than anybody I've ever seen. They've got to have it or their system's not going to work.
Yeah.
And they told me it's a pencil problem at this point. It's not a hardware problem.
Are you familiar with Turing, the Turing question?
No, I'm not.
Well, Robert Turing was one of the pioneers in the AI field. A guy named Marvin Minsky has written about him quite extensively. But Robert Turing, back in the 60s, proposed the kind of like the quintessential question about whether AI exists or not. And the question is, if a human being was talking to a microphone, and there was a computer or a human behind that microphone, when you get to the point where the human being can't tell the difference between the computer and the human,
yeah,
that's when you really have AI. And I've also, from a corporate standpoint, delved into it a bit. There's a guy at UC Santa Cruz that has written the chess program. It's not anything on the level of the IBM thing this year. But this guy wrote this chess program, and he's pretty good about beating computers in chess, but the computer is the AI that decides how to play the chess game.
Wow.
And, you know, I think it's really just more of an academic field at this point. I'm very, very curious about it from a mathematical standpoint.
I'm more curious on a philosophical level, I guess. It's really not my area, but I'm just curious.
Well, the Turing question, that really is the essential question of artificial intelligence. And the Turing question, you know, as I said before, it says, when you can create a computer-based sentience or intelligence that can fool a human being, mm-hmm, then you've finally arrived at the goal. And, I think we're a few years off from that, but I think that's a good test of the question.
I think the rest of your
story is just great. You know, I just want to say, Art, as far as these kind of guests that you have on, I really believe these people because, you know, these people, they're not coming from the left field. These are real people. You just happen to have them on your program. I got on here. I just happened to be on here. And we're all telling our story. And I'm going to get off here, but I just want to just say I'm really behind your guest, and you are.
All right, my friend. Thank you. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Hello, Aaron. How are you?
I'm fine.
This is Wendell. I'm calling from Des Plaines, right outside of Chicago.
Windy city.
Yes.
I wonder, with the coming weather, how much windier it's going to get.
It was pretty windy over the weekend, and we battened down the hatches, believe me.
Oh,
yep.
Man.
I had several questions, actually, for your guest. David, how are you?
Fine. How you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you. A little tired, but I caught the show on the drive home, and I didn't want to go to bed just yet. I find your story just incredible. It's fascinating. It's kind of unbelievable, but I do believe it. It doesn't surprise me at all that the government would be involved in this type of research and then try and cover it up for 20 or 30 years. What brought you to tell your story at this time? Where are you going in this direction?
Stephen Greer had a lot to do with it. He
how did he find you?
People heard. I was real quiet about it, but about 9 months ago, I talked to a few friends. That was the first mistake, about something that happened with me, and I really didn't give a lot of particulars on it, but it's definitely UFO technology, and it's really rare because I've really very rarely talked about it. I mostly talk about space industrial applications and how we can do that type of manufacturing space. But it came up, and I answered some questions about it. Some people got a feeling there's a lot more than he's saying. So they called Greer, then Greer called me.
How did Greer vet you? In other words, how did he dig into your story?
Oh, man, he... I felt like I went through a sieve with the guy. He had hundreds of questions. We talked for about two solid months before the testimony, and the more he would ask, and he'd ask things and come back and ask more things, and I'd send him paperwork, then he'd ask this, and I'd send paper trails, and finally he must have a file about 9 feet thick on me by now. But
I'll bet he did, because to take this story to Congress, Greer had his butt on the line big time.
He really, the boy really stepped out.
And Greer is one serious guy.
He's very serious. Not to be taken lightly about it. And that was one of the things that pulled me toward him, because I have 9 medical doctors in my family. And, of course, he's an ER doctor. And so I just know how they think and feel and how they operate. And I could deal with that. And I mean that in a kind way. But he just finally started just collating everything together. And he just said, there's just too much cohesion here. Just everything is starting to stick together. And you're checking out on stuff. And then he just finally said, you got to testify. And I drug my feet up until 4 days before this testifying was to take place, and I finally said, okay, I'll go. And they sent me a plane ticket, and off I went. But the thing that really got me to answer the question why I did it now is because Greer wasn't sure or not, but he really had a feeling they might do a major disclosure at this meeting. And I was sitting there knowing what I went through. I thought, God, if I don't go and I miss a full disclosure behind closed doors, and I had a chance to hear it, I just couldn't resist it, and so I decided to take the oath and take the risk and see if they were going to make a full disclosure. Maybe I would hear more about what I saw a long time ago. So that's really what pulled me into it, because curiosity killed the cat, maybe. But
I know Dr. Greer to be an incredibly careful person,
right?
And I'm sure that you wouldn't have been in Washington without being fully vetted. So everybody in the audience has got to better bear that in mind as they try to judge your story. That is incredible. Caller, anything else?
Yeah, what exactly, or why was Congress actually investigating this, that they brought you in to testify? Do you think there's a hidden agenda there?
Yeah, but I couldn't figure out what it was, because they looked as nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. And
kind of afraid of what they might hear?
Yeah, and like, you know, this is strange. Why are these people stepping out of line doing this? They don't have to do this. That's the thing that really struck me. Congress and Senate does not have to do this, but they went ahead and set up an official hearing. First time I ever knew of on this subject.
Yeah, I've never heard anything of this.
No, not this magnitude. I'm going, God, what kind of party is this, you know? And I'm going, it's wild. I'll pay my dues. I'll take the risk. I've got to see what's going on. And I don't know what their agenda was, just to see how much we knew or whatever, and or to see how far some of us would be willing to testify.
Do you ever think you'll do any kind of research again in the future in this?
Yeah. God, this thing's never left my soul. It's
I can imagine. That's quite
boring with it, and it's kind of like Jimmy Connors would play tennis up till about age 17, never play again. But in a day, he wouldn't think about it.
You want to build another engine?
That's
what I was thinking.
Probably the ultimate end to the question for all critics.
It certainly would be.
I am going to build it again. It's a matter of time. I'm just trying to get all my duckies in a row in the corporate arena. Because it's going to be a different game this time.
You have no fear of all of the men in black knocking on your door in the middle of the night?
If they do, they come and get me and cart me off, and I'm gone. You know, they shoot me, I'm dead. I'm out of here, I go back to God. So what? That's a big deal? You know, it doesn't matter. All the time you're here on this planet, it's your own loan anyhow.
Good point.
Well, don't worry about it. Thank you, caller. Incredible. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Hi, Art. Hi, Dr. Adair.
Not doctor.
Not yet. I've got my VA, and I'm on my way to master's here, but I will be.
Sorry. Okay, well, listen, I have to admit that this is a highly unbelievable story, and you know what? It probably is true, but my sense of curiosity wants me to ask you to possibly, for the audience, briefly describe what happens when tritium and deuterium particle combine, and if you could be specific, maybe give it MEV and whatever you can, just to be specific and share some knowledge with the audience, just to verify.
When a tritium and deuterium particle combine?
In a fusion reaction.
Enormous heat energy occurs when you have your atoms fusing into that arena. There's also the way the tutorial design was made, when the systems collide for the energy interaction on this thing, I got a cone shape effect out of the back end on the back end of the particle accelerator. Let me explain what the engine looked like. That might help.
All right, listen, both of you. Let me hold you both over.
All right.
Both of you, stay right there.
Cool. Well.
Hold on, relax. We'll be back. From the high desert, this is CBC. I'm Art Bell. David Adair is here.
Her hair is hollow gold. Her lips sweet surprise. Her hands are never cold. She's got Betty Davis eyes. She'll turn the music on you. You won't have to think twice. She's pure as New York snow. She got Betty Davis eyes.
Toll free, west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. 1-800-825-5033. This is the CBC Radio Network.
It absolutely is. My guest is David Adair, and I'll tell you something. The temptation would be to say, what a bunch of bull. And I know that some of you are. But I know Dr. Stephen Greer. He's a really, really serious guy. He would have vetted David Adair very carefully before he allowed him to come in front of Congress. Very carefully. In fact, David Adair, under oath, threat of perjury and going to jail, testified to what you just heard over the last 3.5 hours, April 9th, 1997, behind closed doors, with Stephen Greer, Dr. Stephen Greer. So you better stop and you better scratch your head real hard before you say, what a fish story. Maybe you better scratch again. You know, I do this every now and then, and I'm going to do it again right now. Every now and then, I'll pop into a chat room. And if you'd like to come join me, come on in. The water's fine. It's on America Online. All you do is log on to AOL, go to keyword Art Bell, and that'll, you know, click on keyword and just put in my name, Art Bell, any combination, letters, however you do it. It'll take you over to the Periscope area, and then you go into the grassy knoll, and you'll find a whole bunch of people in there, chatting, no doubt discussing this show, and saying heaven knows what. So by now they believe that, yes, this show is live. They've been debating that in there for some godforsaken reason. And secondly, in a moment they're going to find out how it fills up, so come on in. Well, all right, we're already getting inundated here with requests for how to get a copy of this program. Not surprised. By calling 1-800-917-4278. That's 1-800-917-4278. I'll repeat it one more time in self-defense. Please don't fax me. Please write down the number if you want a copy of this program. It's no doubt going to be a five-hour show. It's 1-800-917-4278. the program with David Adair. David, we're back on the air again.
Okay.
Have you written a book?
Yes, I have. It's not published yet. It's called America's Fall from Space. It's about 456 pages.
America's Fall from Space. And how many pages?
About 456 pages.
That's a big book.
Yeah.
But it's not published, so there's no point, I guess, in...
Not right yet. I've got publishers coming at me, and I'm trying to sort through which deal I want.
I understand.
Which I guess that's kind of unusual, because for a first-time writer, it surprised me.
And well, it doesn't surprise me, not based on what you've said and based on what you've done. Caller, you're back on the air again with David Adair. Thank you for waiting.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, good, go.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Adair?
Yes, sir.
See, I know, I'm sure that a million people are saying that is probably the most bizarre thing they've ever heard in their life.
I don't blame them.
And it really is. I mean, it's I can't see how you could make something like that up, because that's just too insane to make it up. But
right.
Can you briefly describe what led to your creation of this motor, what inspired you, what educational or interest that you had at that age that
right.
led you to design?
That's an excellent question. Where did I start? The space sciences that I work with, and it started ever since memory started. I had the ability, even when I was 7, 8 years old, I was working some interesting math. I had a flair for numbers, I guess. A lot of people said I was gifted, and I don't know about that, but all I know is I could do a lot of this math problems, and all my work that I worked with came to me in dreams, of all things. I had an artist pad I'd sleep with even when I was a child, and I'd wake up sometimes 3, 4 in the morning and write this stuff down, and I kept a journal of it. When I started building rockets, dreams became more frequent and on a regular basis, and so I could get help, or strange that may sound. While I was sleeping, I actually got my best thoughts came through to me. Maybe things were quieter in my head or something, but I was able to write this stuff down. And I used to put them all and tell anybody that until Hawkins told me once that almost all his stuff and his math comes to him through dreams. And
so in other words, this knowledge may have come from elsewhere.
Well, yeah, maybe.
You have no way of saying not.
Well, I can't prove you right or wrong, that's for sure. But I don't know. All I know is that it came to me on a regular basis when I was building the thing. And interestingly, some of my business partners are psychologists that work in some areas of and business deals with them. And some of these guys specialize in, two of these guys specialize in sleep disorders and other problems. And they had told me that at that time, they asked a lot of personal questions about what I was doing. And I told them I was consumed by this thing. It was like 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. I didn't kiss a girl until I was almost 18 years old. I never dated. I was just totally, I don't know if you'd
consumed.
Even like me back then.
I understand consumed.
And so it was like some kind of obsession or I think a mental disorder myself. But it would not leave me alone. And even when I would want to do things like other things, like everybody else, go play football or something like that, I just couldn't stop long enough to go do that. I'd be on the field and I'd have to stop because I had to go back to the lab. It just would not leave me alone. And so the psychologist told me that is not a normal with sometimes you get gifted early on in life, and it just consumes you like a fire. And you're so hot at that moment. It's like an athlete that trains. They're at their peak, and they're capable of great things. And then when you're older and you go back to try to do it, you never quite reach that peak again. At that moment in time.
That's right.
So I'm sitting there going, oh, God, and, you know, I thought, oh, I hate to think I went through this and I can't do it again. But
obviously, you could go that far again.
I think I could. I'm not, you know, I don't know. Maybe I can. I do know that it's just not like, oh, you did it once, like riding a bicycle, you can do it again. It's a little bit more complicated than that. And also, it's going to change my personality, and I really don't know if I have a wife now and family and all that stuff, and I don't know if I want to go into that mode again like that.
I understand.
It may tear my private life up. And so I've been able to compartmentalize this thing for 27 years and never think about it. You know, and you ask people, they work on stuff.
When was the first moment you told it publicly?
Only about 9 months ago.
Where?
It was in Asheville, North Carolina.
Asheville,
yeah. And of all things, I went in on a friend of mine who is a professional videographer was setting cameras and lights up for something called Ekankar, which is some kind of metaphysical.
I know what that is, yes.
Some kind of metaphysical thing. And I told the guy, I said, oh, God, don't tell them anything about me. I said, I just put a baseball cap on and had raggedy clothes, and I said, I'll set your lights up. Just tell them I'm a roadie. And so we were okay until some guy sitting there, he's kind of leader, he turned around to me and he said, who is your channel or channeler or do you channel something like that? And I went, HBO, Cinemax, you know?
And kind of I've got to remember that response.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. They asked, who's your guide? And I went, Tonto? You know, I don't know. I had no idea what they're talking about. But they asked me what I do, and I told them that, I'm a technology transfer consultant, and we do research in space where we can grow super electronic crystals and alloys and medical research. Well, the crystal things got them all fired up, and so much for the Ekankar meeting. And
yeah, I'm sure they went wild on crystals.
And my friend looked over at him. He was holding his face in his hands like he's dreading this. And I don't know, something just struck me. I thought, well, this crowd is kind of remote from my life. I'll just throw this on and see what happens. And that's when
it got out.
That's exactly how it got out, because some of these people in that crowd, Stephen Greer lives in Asheville, North Carolina. And some of these were his neighbors, and they went over and told him. And
that's how it happened.
That's how it happened.
I've got you. All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Good evening.
Good evening. Good morning, actually. Where are you?
I'm in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Philadelphia. All right. Speak up good and loud and get close to your phone.
Okay. The question and answer previous was wonderful. In fact, it answered a lot of what I had in my head. But what I was wondering is if... the fact that Mr. Adair, that you said that you were consumed by this, sounded very familiar to Mr. Doug Ruby's conversation.
Yes, didn't it? Now, you're right.
It did. And and from what you just said about not wanting your life to be changed because of, you know, your situation now, well, it seems like Mr. Ruby, things are being made very easy for him, and the fact that you have it in your heart and soul that this information is in you, and I don't think it'll ever go away, maybe it'll be made a little easier with a little collaboration with others that also are in the same or similar situation.
That's so interesting. Now, what does Doug Ruby do?
It's a long story. Okay. Doug Ruby learned how to decipher crop circles, David.
Oh, my goodness.
By spinning them and seeing them in a third, in three dimensions instead of just the normal.
Oh, my.
It's a long story, but he was consumed with it.
But also the fact that they were engines that he was creating.
Yes. The crop circles, David, according to Doug Ruby, actually are designs for ships and propulsion systems, much like the one you're talking about.
My goodness.
It's, it gets thicker and thicker. Thank you very much, caller. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with David Adair. Good morning. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is Mike in Fresno.
Hi, Mike.
I have I think it's about three questions.
All right. Always give credit to KFRE.
Oh, absolutely.
Fresno. All right. Go ahead.
I'm glad they got the program.
Me too.
Having gone to school there in San Francisco, one chemistry teacher and one physics teacher set my mind into negative cancellation of waves. the engine you saw, you said the flow was in a different direction than the one that you designed, right?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Was that capable, do you think, of creating, since it's connected to black holes with your mathematical theory, a gravity field capable of generating gravity waves that, if out of phase, would cancel gravity as it traveled?
Oh, what an interesting thought. boy, that, now you're done. I won't sleep tonight. Thanks.
Now, the next thought, that was Paul Hewitt, I think his name. He wrote Conceptual Physics. He was one of my teachers. And
Hilbert
Johnson wrote Chemical Calculations and Computations. They worked. They taught at San Francisco City College, but were also out of Berkeley. I had some pretty good teachers.
I'd say you did.
Anyway, the next thing is, would it be capable of producing enough power, and say applied to something like Art's parts, to turn around and, over a broad spectrum, produce electromagnetic waves that would, through negative cancellation, cancel out any reflected electromagnetic waves, making it sort of invisible? Is that possible?
Would there be enough power in an engine like that? It would have to change the frequency vibration of the atomic structure of the immediate environment of which it's encased in around.
Which is really what they did, they think, at the Philadelphia experiment.
That's what I understand.
Parts is made of some strange material.
It is. Bismuth and magnesium. It's some parts that I've got. They still haven't figured out. But what he was just talking about really was kind of what they were working on in Philadelphia way back when.
Yeah, and didn't they wrap a coil around the ship? I forgot the name of the ship. But,
actually, they had gigantic electromagnetic coils. They had rotating RF fields.
And Tesla did that, didn't he?
Yes. Yes. Yes, absolutely. East of the Rockies, you're on air with David Adair. Hello.
Hello?
Hello.
Is this there?
It's you.
Oh, okay. I thought you. I didn't hear East of the Rockies.
Where are you?
This is Atlanta.
Atlanta, Georgia. Okay.
David, I just want to apologize for the United States for cutting you off at the kneecaps when you're 16 years old. They should never do that to a young man, because you had a lot to bring to the table. I'm 44 myself, so I got to see all kinds of things when I was growing up, because my dad went from the demolition business to restoring a house in Noonan, Georgia, to sinking Florida with concrete before I was 20 years old. So I got to be around a lot of stuff myself before I was 20 years old, and that should have never been done to you. And I apologize for the United States for doing that to you.
You shouldn't have to apologize.
I was going to mention that there was two shows on TV in the last year, Space Above and Beyond, which was sci-fi, and Babylon 5, which dealt with the shadows. Did you ever see one of those shows?
I've seen some of the episodes, but I don't know the shadow that you're referring to.
Okay, the shadows were ships that attacked them that looked like they were alive. And if you can ever see those episodes, because it'd be in rerun, but they had some kind of sentient thing that was operating them. Anyway, Space and, Above and Beyond, that was a similar thing where the aliens were ships that were like alive. In fact, in Space Above and Beyond, they got in the ship, and the ship went crazy.
Oh,
they couldn't think. I saw that episode.
Yeah, the control thing, they stuck their arms in the walls or something.
Let me ask you something, David. Let's say that you had gone ahead and just gone with the program back there at 51, Area 51.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think you would have gone with this? You know, would your technology have grown? You know, your mind was young.
I tell you, you were just really sharp. It's like kind of like a delayed action stress syndrome for a Vietnam veteran. It's like there's not a day that goes by I don't think about what if.
Yeah.
I don't know. They would have offered me everything. I would have had labs. I would have had whatever I wanted. But, my God, I don't know what kind of world we would have had.
Hey, Art?
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you something. I meant to ask you this last time. What happened with the cold fusion water heater?
It's very much alive. We'll have Wayne Green on again, who will talk about that, caller. Thank you very much. All right, what I want you to do, David, is just stand by. We'll be back to you after the top of the hour. This gives you a good chance to rest, all right?
Yeah.
All right, good.
Thanks.
I'm sure you can use it. What an incredible story. If you have questions for David Adair, we've got another hour to let you ask them. The best radio made today, anywhere in the entire world, is the Zanjin ATS-909. That's just a flat statement. Now, as a matter of fact, the World Radio TV Handbook independently gave the Zanjin 909 a 5-star rating and named it the best shortwave portable for 1997. Before they ever did, I did. I said, I've never seen a radio of this quality. Never. And it's the truth. I have never seen a radio of this quality in my life. It's a portable. It's relatively small, comparatively small. Say up against the 818CS, smaller than, certainly the Grundig Satellite 700, and probably closer to the size of the Sony 2010. But the important part is, it puts them all in the dirt. Performance-wise, it puts them in the dirt. And I know a lot of people sitting out there shaking their heads saying, oh, come on, I've heard of 2010. Well, so have I, I've got one. And put them side by side, and the 2010 given antenna input overloads, the 909 does not. That's construction, baby. Sensitivity, selectivity, it's the very best RDS reception on FM, a down to 40 hertz resolution on sideband. It is virtually a communications radio in the body of a portable, and a high-grade one at that. It is the best radio you can buy, period. The number to call, oh, the price, $269.95. And trust me when I tell you it's worth every single penny. The number to call in the morning is 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. The Sea Crane Company. Now, one other item. We may have crashed the rogue market. Keep trying. If you can't get through this morning, then by all means, tomorrow during the day, or whenever you can manage to get through, go by my webpage, which is where the Area 51 photograph is, www.artbell.com. And there you will see the rogue market, where you can jump over, go to Talk Radio, and buy some shares. I'm in a very competitive situation over there, and I'm having more fun with this than I've had with anything in a whole long time. So it's not real money, but you can trade it like it's real money, and you can actually buy stock in Art Bell. So I'm saying buy, 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 and the sooner you get in there, the sooner, well, the more money you make, because it's going nothing but straight up. Like David's rockets, straight up. We'll be right back.
Taking calls on the wildcard line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First-time callers can reach Art Bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again, Art Bell.
Once again, I am here. My guest is David Adair. What a wild night. And I want to remind the audience once again to avoid having to answer the questions a million by email. I'm getting them already by fax. If you want a copy of this program, the number to call is 1-800-917-4278. You can begin calling now. It's going to be a 5-hour program. 1-800-917-4278. It'll be a classic, no doubt about it. Tomorrow night. In fact, we've got a whole bunch of classics coming up. Tomorrow night, James Collier. He wrote a book called Vote Scam, and now has written a second book saying we never went to the moon. Never went to the moon. He will be here to debate Richard Hoagland. That's right, Richard Hoagland, who knows damn well we went to the moon, because that's when he was working for Walter Cronkite. That'll be tomorrow night. The next night, there is a guest so sensitive that I can't even talk to you about him right now. Assuming that it all goes through, and you know what happens when you assume. The following night, from the City University of New York, a professor of theoretical physics named Michio Kaku. You're really going to enjoy that one. And then Monday, James von Prague. So we've got a lot of stuff on tap coming up. A whole bunch of stuff on tap coming up. It's going to be a wild time. All right, back to David in a moment. Well, this is kind of a story that'll change your life. David Adair, back on the air again. David,
yes,
how are you holding up?
I'm still here. I'm on autopilot, but I'm still here.
All right. Well, we've got lots of people out there that want to ask questions. First time caller line, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Good morning, Art. I have a bad connection, so I'll ask a question and hang up to listen to the answer.
Sure.
David, I admire your courage and your curiosity here, and I was wondering if you'd thought about this aspect, that if you're going to speed of light, you're probably going a long distance and you want to know where you're going, and you're going to have to avoid some asteroids and probably stop when you get there, and you might want to come home too. So considering the size of this rocket, the kind of craft it'd have to be in, you know, how far could it go, and where could it be coming from? Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right.
I can only speculate on that. There's no way I could possibly know, and I can only give you an assessment on what I saw and make some projections, so bear with that. Certainly not omnipresent knowledge here, know all, see all, by any means.
Mm-hmm.
But for a craft to move like that, it's capable of light speed. It may be even better than that. I never got a chance to finish my work, but there was a secondary thing to this engine I would like to have done. I believe that the magnetic fields of this thing could be extended in a contained pattern outside the ship. If that could be done, then what you can create, since that field has the intensity of a black hole, you could create an artificial black hole around the craft. If that's so, then you can warp space by wrapping around you like a burrito, and the shortest point between two points like A and B is not a linear line, but rather pull the space, wrap it around you, and then it's just the thickness of those two points connecting, which on a linear plane is nothing. So it's kind of like a riddle that could be solved. How can you go thousands of times faster than the speed of light without breaking the speed of light? You could do that with a gravity well, gravitron well, like a black hole, because we know that's the only thing in space that can bend light. When light comes at us from a star and a black hole passes between us, it will actually bend the light. So you could bend time and space, and that's still a theory. There's a movie that just came out a couple of days ago called Event Horizon. The engine that they have in there is exactly what I'm talking about. The way they've got it set up, though, is it's entirely Hollywood. It's been Hollywood eyes, and it really can't do the way they have it set up. It'd be an entirely different setup. But the theory and the way they explain it is good, but from that point on, it turns to a B-movie where bad aliens chasing people to eat you up. You know,
yeah.
Geez. But, boy, they really had a good thing going in the first 20 or 30 minutes of that movie. They did a good job explaining how these engines could work like that. I only think about it now and then. So to answer your question, this craft could come from billions of light years in a fairly reasonable time that we could stand ourselves. Or they could have been traveling for millions of years themselves, so I don't know what kind of timetable they have or whatever. But that craft would be capable of distances we could only dream about right now. I'm pretty sure they could be doing, could travel like that.
David, let me take you off for a second.
Okay.
All right, I'm certain you're aware, but a lot of the audience may not be, that Stephen Greer of CSETI and his assistant have both come down with very deadly forms of cancer.
I'm not aware of that. I heard a couple rumors, and I was going to, when I get home, I was going to give him a call and ask him.
Stephen Greer has been diagnosed with metastatic malignant melanoma. That's bad stuff.
Yeah.
And Sherry has been diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer of the right breast.
Oh, man.
Which has metastasized, I guess, to the lymph nodes. I mean, these are both really, really serious cancers.
Yeah, they got chemotherapy coming. Oh, God, they're going to have a hard time. I heard rumors. I didn't want to. I normally don't believe anything until I get the first source.
No, it's true.
God, I hate hearing that.
Now, you know, I'm not Mel Gibson. And I don't believe every conspiracy theory comes along, and I'm not saying this is one, but I'm saying the odds against that.
Both of them coming down at the same time.
Yeah, it's a little high. Pretty strange odds, yeah. And I'll just leave it there.
That's a shame.
It is, and I thought the audience ought to know.
All
right, Wildcard Line, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
I just really thank you for the quality of your work tonight, Art.
Thank you.
And I have a question. What might I tune? I'm in WAI, and I have lost the current live show. Where might I tune to? And the question for your guest is, if you were able to adapt this to cold fusion and not operate at a million degrees, might you be able to make the mythical greater-than-unity engine that would free all of mankind from the energy lords and gods that really run higher society?
Well, actually, that's a very good question. I cannot tell you where to tune. They go to their morning show, of course, as a natural course of events, caller. If you had a computer, you could listen to us on Real Audio.
Oh, I do, but I don't have an IP provider.
Well, get an IP provider.
Is there a large clear channel station like WAI? Like,
yeah, there probably is. Like, try 890 Chicago. I bet they come roaring down there.
I'll try it.
All right. In the meantime, his question is a good one.
Right.
Cold fusion right now is much more of a, let's see, what's the right word?
Holy Grail?
No, not Holy Grail. Cold fusion is a much more subtle process. that's what I was reaching for. Now, obviously, if we could ever harness the kind of energy you're talking about that was used in your engine and their engine, we would have all the energy we could use, wouldn't we?
Yeah, you would, but I don't think you even have to go to this technology for the application. I was in Korea about 4 months ago, and there was a new science symposium there, and this scientist from Japan showed the cold fusion process that our two guys here in America came out with, and then it kind of got shot down real quick. I forgot the two guys that did that, if you remember who I'm talking about.
Pons and Fleshman.
Right. Well, this little fellow over in Japan took their design and modified it.
That's what I've heard.
And I couldn't believe it. I was sitting there watching the film that he filmed in his lab in the contraption, and man, I tell you, that guy looked like he's got cold fusion cooking, and he believes he has it, but he couldn't get the country of Japan to really cooperate with him.
Now, it's very interesting. I understand they backed some funding away at the last minute.
Yeah, they did.
And I haven't quite figured out what occurred there yet.
He was left hanging, and I've got his card, and I've talked to him a couple times. But he was in Korea demonstrating that, and since then I've got him connected with some significant people funding over in, it was the people at the ESA, the European Space Agency, and they were highly interested, and he's now talking to them. But that was really fascinating. I mean, it looked like he had it. because the way the thing was running, it cranked up a lot of heat and power out.
Mm-hmm. All right, east of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair. Good morning.
Hello, Mr. Bell. Hello, Mr. Adair. Sean from Murphy, North Carolina.
Yes, sir.
Oh, my wife was born there.
Wow. I was wondering, a hydrogen bomb uses a fusion reaction to detonate. Did this rocket engine use a self-contained fusion reaction and focused it to power itself?
Yeah, that's pretty much
okay.
That's close, yeah.
And how did you start the reaction?
With a small particle accelerator. I didn't get a chance to explain. Another caller called and was asking something like that, and we really didn't get to answering. I was describing what the engine looks like. This is not a scientific explanation, but it's pretty graphic. Think of two octopuses intertwined having sex. Okay? It's pretty graphic, but it's pretty accurate. The round parts would be on each end. Are the particle accelerators, and the mass of the tentacles all in and around would be the mass flow for the fusion process. If you look at those two, you can draw a figure eight in between them, with the two round things in each end, and that's how I channeled the flow of the reaction process. So, like anything in the infinity loop, the faster it runs, the more power it provides from the reaction, which feeds self-feeding its own field. So what's happening is no matter how powerful it's getting inside, the field is one step above it. So the field could never, the energy source could never overtake the field for containment, and it's in a perpetual loop.
You got to stay close to the phone for me, Dan.
Oh, I'm sorry. And it's a perpetual loop in the figure eight infinity pattern, and that's how the containment was achieved. I hope I answered your question.
How do you start the particle accelerators?
Oh, standard accelerating particles where I had an outside external flow, where I had a chain reaction of a detonation, the pre-detonation that started the reaction. I don't know if you're familiar with how the Manhattan Project device was built. Have you ever seen a picture of the original H-bomb?
Jumbo?
Right. It looked like a soccer ball.
Yeah.
Okay. And you had, at one time, if you had a soccer ball in 1945, it would have locked you up forever. Because there would have been a top secret device. That pattern, remember all the wires going into that thing?
Mm-hmm.
It's just thousands of wires. Those are all many little explosives, and the trick to that thing was to get all these detonations to occur simultaneously, exploding inward at the same exact precise force which caused the reaction to go off. I used the same type of explosion. If you remember me saying, I had miles of wiring in this thing. I had the same type of reaction on a detonation explosion that kicked off the accelerators, which then kicked off the hydrogen reaction process.
Sort of like with a battery starting an alternator.
Well said. Exactly.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, caller. Take care. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. Good morning, David. This is Terry in beautiful Northern California listening to KSRO up here in Santa Rosa. And I've got to tell you, Art, I've been just thoroughly impressed with your show and the guest. And David has been the best one thus far that I've listened to over the last
few months. Glad
you're enjoying it. Well, that's a way of a comment, because he's had some really heavy-duty speakers on there.
Oh, yeah, it's been quite a lineup. But I've got to say, your story has certainly caught my attention, and I sent artifacts requesting that you contact me about doing a movie deal. And in fact, I'd like to talk to you about doing the book deal as well. I think we've got the best deal for authors going. So if Art would pass that on to you.
Right. I'm going to leave an address at some here in the program, Art, that where people can write to me.
Oh, great.
All right. As a matter of fact, why don't we do that? That will settle the caller's question.
Okay.
Give us an address.
Here we go. 108 Park Place. We're next door to Boardwalk. Just kidding. 108 Park Place.
Yes.
Stockbridge, one word.
How do you spell that?
STOCKBRIDGE. Georgia, 30281.
30281. Right. And just put David Adair?
Right. If you wonder where in God's name that place is, I'm hanging on the edge of the outer belt of Atlanta. So I live in Atlanta.
Okay, David Adair, 108 Park Place.
Right.
Stockbridge, Georgia, 30281.
Right. Also, since we're in a commercial vein here, I have two places here in L.A. I'm speaking at, and I thought I'd give those out.
That's why you're in L.A.
Right. And actually, the real reason I'm helping finishing building a house for a friend of mine. Yeah, I do construction work, among other things. But
Where are you speaking in L.A.?
All right, on Thursday, this coming Thursday, the 21st,
right.
I will be speaking to the Granada Forum. And there's a phone number you can call for information. It will be at 7:30 p.m. And the number is 818-385-4003.
Got it.
And they can call that. That's a information number that they can get.
Are you going to be essentially repeating the story you've been telling to me?
No, actually, I'm going to talk about what I really do, where I shape metal in space with sound waves, and we can do three-dimensional casting of metals out there. I'll talk about pharmaceuticals that we can make out there, and electronic crystals. If people want to know more about what we're talking tonight, I'll answer questions there, too.
And your second appearance?
Second appearance is this coming Saturday, the 23rd. Of all things, it's UFO Lectures of Orange County.
Huh.
It's also 7:30 p.m., and the contact number there for information is 714-760-0275.
Okay. 714-760-0275.
Right.
And you gave out your address. What would you like to hear from people?
Golly, that's a great question.
It's like you don't have a book to sell yet, so.
No, and that's the whole thing. I never written anything as far as, you know, the sales stuff. I just made some videotapes on all the type of work I've done, and my God, I can't believe how many tapes have been sold. I'm not used to this stuff, so I'm kind of learning as I go here because I'm just normally a normal person doing my job. But I would like to know from people.
I'll tell you what. Think about that during the break.
Yeah, it's a great question, Art. You're good for that stuff.
All right, hold on. All right, if you want a copy of this program, 1-800-917-4278 is the number. That's 1-800-917-4278.
Toll free, west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. 1-800-825-5033. This is the CBC Radio Network.
It is, and I'm hearing from an awful lot of people that they're hearing on network TV about what we've been talking about here for actually the last couple of years, and certainly heavily in the last many, many months, Echoes of Standeo, the El Nino that is building, some of the forecasts they're beginning to give for California really are frightening. And it's not just California, it's the whole Southwest. And that includes me. And when it rains the kind of rain they're talking about here in the desert, it's dangerous quickly. Some of these forecasts are talking about 40 inches of rain. Days and days and days of unending rain. We're going to have to get a climatologist on the air, and we will do that. But this is a quickly now building story in the mainstream media. My guest is incredible, David Adair. The program has been incredible, and if you don't have this archived, you better get it. So the way to get it is to call 1-800-917-4278. 1-800-917-4278. All right, back now to David Adair, and what I asked David was what you would like them to write.
Yes, I'd like for them to write to me and request my book. Let me put them on the mailing list.
Mailing list.
Right, and give me your full mailing address and phone number, so when we get the book out, I'll make sure you're notified where you can get a copy of it.
All right. Excellent. And I guess you won't even know any of that until you find out who's going to publish. And,
right. And it's a sort through it all.
Long way down line. I take it also that you would like to hear anybody who has had or can confirm your experiences or had similar
ones. Boy, really, I'd really like to hear from somebody that was in Area 51 in 1971, if they're out there and they could contact me.
Oh, they're out there.
I would like for them to, if they remember an incident that I just described. So there were several people there. There was, at least I saw a dozen in the peripherals. There was people. So there's some that saw this stuff.
All right, here's somebody who asked, David, were you at any time debriefed by the officials at Area 51?
No, I wasn't. I guess it never came to that because LeMay interjected and... he was in a bad mood that moment, and he took me. He just pulled me out and took me home.
All right, to the phones. We're coming down the home stretch here, so you'll be to sleep soon, David.
No, I'm gonna be a lightweight here.
First time caller line. You're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Hello.
Where are you?
Call toll free 1-800-618-8255.
David mentioned.
I'm sorry, Francis, I had to bleep that out because we don't allow last names on the air. So let's just say your name is Francis.
Francis.
Right.
With an I.
Okay.
Okay, the question. He mentioned that while he was examining the engine that was about the size of what he felt would be a Greyhound bus.
Yes.
Where did he ever see, or David, did you ever see, or where is the vehicle that this engine propelled?
Excellent question. I don't know. I'm assuming that it was in that area, maybe in a different bay or something. And the thing I was curious about is I could only extrapolate in proportional dimensional size. My engine is the size of a football. It took about a 10 to 12-foot rocket housing for all the peripherals. For that. So if this thing was the size, if this thing was the size of a school bus, I couldn't imagine how big the craft could be. It could be the size of a football field, or it could be the size of a aircraft carrier. It would have to be a pretty large craft because this engine would be capable of tremendous power, so it would be a sizable craft. And
actually, I appreciate your answer. It's a good answer. Sometimes you need to hear, I don't know, or I didn't see it.
That's
and
true.
I would not have expected you to have seen it. They only brought you in for one reason.
Right.
And that's obvious, having heard your story. And they didn't want you to know anymore.
No, they didn't. And what was interesting, though, is that this thing was, it wasn't torn. It was cut out of the craft.
Oh.
And, if that was the fittings on the side.
So everything had been cut.
Yeah, and there were some rips and tears where I guess the initial impact when it went down occurred, but mostly they were clean severs. But I don't know what they cut it with, because that's really interesting that they could cut it like that. But the thing of noteworthy that I remembered mostly is the fittings that this thing had.
Fittings?
The fittings, you know, like we have B-nut fittings and we have quick disconnect couplings.
Yes.
And this thing's fittings, I don't know how to say this on radio, but it gave a whole new definition to male and female fittings. The female fitting looked like a...
First-time callers call area 702-727-1222.
Slid in, and when they did, there was two of the couplings were still fastened, and they looked like they were one solid piece, like a fuse.
Let's just shorten that to male and female organs.
Okay, I'm sorry. That's the science in it.
That's right.
I didn't get you in trouble, Art.
No. Look, that actually makes all the sense in the world, because it is, after all, the natural way.
Well, there was something else interesting about the entire...
And everything about that engine was natural, including, according to you, the way it was commanded.
Do you remember seeing artwork by a man named H.R. Geiger? H.R. Geiger is a man that designed all the... It's called organic technology. He designed all the creatures in Alien. In Alien movies, you know, Sigourney Weaver?
Yes.
This thing had the same kind of overall technological manufacturing look. It was like an organic technology.
Yeah.
This thing looked like it could have grown itself.
Oh, I hear you. Caller, anything else?
Yes. On this, how would our space system be affected if this computer year 2000 compliance is not corrected?
I'm not following. It's a computer 2000 appliance.
That's where
he's worried about the zeros in the year 2000. Millennial bug in computers in the year 2000.
How would that affect our space program? Corrected.
All right.
Only thing I can think of, either depends on the administration. It would either be an adverse effect, or it could be a positive. Just depends on how they want to induce that technology. And the problem the space program's got, the biggest problem of all, they have no leadership. They have no goals. They have no short-range, long-range plans. We got a little probe on Mars.
At least no public ones.
Right. And, well, okay, I agree. Okay, you win. Right. I'm only on a 3D level here. But, you know, as far as I can see, it's pitiful. There's no step-by-step ladder for us to go somewhere. That just seems random. And, you know, it's just, let's spend a block of money here. And the thing that I find more interesting is there's such a push by Golden, Dan Golden, to the head of NASA. They want to go to Mars. You know, why in God's name we want to go 464 million miles in one direction or approximately that far when all we got to do is go 240,000 miles to our moon? Why don't we go back to the moon? Nobody wants to talk about going back to the moon.
No, we're going to talk about the moon tomorrow night.
No.
Wild Card Line, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, I'm Walter from up here in Mount Rainier, Washington.
Yes, sir.
And I'd like to say thanks a lot, David, for doing this. It's you're really helping out in the greatest way. And all we have to get the serious thing is those people have guilt over who they've had killed and stuff over this. You would make a really good PR man, because that guilt is the only thing that's stopping us now. But anyway, we have those ships up here, the ones that move erratically, and they can go in any direction they want to. And I'm sure they can. At certain times up here, things get, I don't know, there's tensions around. These crafts can move in any direction, just minute, super speeds. And when you see one, it'll be red. And I'll tell you, it's a red light. And that's all I can say about them, because I don't know any more about them except that they're here with us all the time.
All right, well, we certainly have plenty of sightings of things like that. And
I wish I could see one.
I've seen a couple of craft, David. I've seen two. And, you know, I couldn't sit here and tell you exactly what I saw, other than it was technology that either was A, generations and generations beyond what we have announced we have, or it was from somewhere else. I don't know. You know, they didn't drag anything along with him that explained all that to me. I just saw it.
The owner's manual didn't drop out on
you. Yeah, there you go. And I take it on that big engine, it didn't either.
No, I was looking for an owner's operator manual. I couldn't find one.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Good morning, Art. This is Ken from Uniontown in southwestern Pennsylvania.
Yes, sir.
I have one quick question, if I may. I've been catching your show erratically throughout the night due to the rainy weather and skip bouncing all around.
Right.
With all this technology out there and everything that seems to be going on around the world and tying in with your book, The Quickening, couldn't the government just turn this on its own people and this technology against its own people to just basically make us all a bunch of slaves to the government? Maybe it's just me being paranoid, but it's a little scary to think about. I mean, look how long they've kept Area 51 secret from us.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's just my paranoid mind working against me, the end of the millennium type of thing, but it just scares the bejesus out of me.
Well, obviously you're an intelligent person, because first thing you can, an intelligent creature is aware of, that things are getting dangerous around it. I'm afraid our society, with the apathy that we have running through America, the democratic system works. People don't laugh at it. No, don't laugh. It does work. But the reason the powers are having such a good time and everything is that they depend on one thing, apathy. As long as that apathy is in a democracy, man, you can have tyrants running things. But until people become cohesive, and instead of being like a flashlight shining on the wall, they become cohesive and become a laser and burn through it, they're not going to have to worry to answer anything. But the system will react, because at one time we pulled together and we absolutely rolled, you know, 40-year control of Democrats out of the office, and they had to bend to that will. We could make things change here if we'd only do it together. What is, I don't know the statistics, but of the registered voters in this country, Art, what is it, like 12% vote? That's it.
Well, it depends on the election you're talking about. Off your elections, you don't get many. You know.
That's just incredibly low.
In local elections, you even get fewer.
Yeah, and I mean, that what you have setting is what you have a real justification for fear. Our democracy is now poised for an absolute dictator to take control. And it'd be a shame. It'd be our own fault if we let it happen.
Okay. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a question for him, and it's regarding the EM fields around the ship he was talking about.
Okay.
With what's it, Hawking's theories of being at the black event horizon of a black hole,
right?
Could you possibly freeze time, and could that be a way of time travel?
Oh, absolutely. See, I'm still stuck in the theory stage. I never got a chance to have any working models with this thing. I had time with it. Eventually, Stephen Hawking agrees with that theorem that in the black hole capability, you would be able to pass through different dimensions and do time travel. Exactly how you set all this up in motion, the navigations, communications, all that stuff, I have more questions than I've got answers. But the theorem that he has, if you read his book of Space and Time, it addresses that issue. And yeah, if you're going to do time travel in a natural way, the way to do it would be the force of a black hole.
Art?
Yes.
One more comment. Thank you. I love your show. You know, it's just very, it piques my intellect, and I've told all my friends around here, so I'm getting possibly a high school club started for you. So.
Thank you, my friend. Take
care. Bye, Art.
Bye.
Bye, Art. I'll say one thing. Your callers, that's a smart bunch of callers out
there.
Oh,
we do have a good group, sure.
Man, you got an intelligent audience out there.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair. Good morning.
Good morning, David and Art. You just answered one of my questions about a book. Is any of the books you could recommend to us, since yours isn't available yet?
I just mentioned one.
I just mentioned one. I was wondering if there's any other books you could recommend to us.
There's a book that NASA ironically puts out. It's called Shuttles at Work.
Shuttles at Work?
Right, and it explains, I think you'll find a lot of interesting stuff in the microgravity processing arena.
right.
The commercial sectors are working. That's an excellent book. There's another old book. Gosh, I don't know if you can find it anymore. It was printed by AAAS, the American Association for Advancement of Science, the cornerstone of our science world here. They produced a book called The Future of Energy.
And, Future of Energy?
Yeah, The Future of Energy. And in that book, it was printed way back in 1971, but they may have a copy of it. But, it's printed in 73, and the date is significant because about a third way through that book, guess what, Art? They got a diagram of my engine.
Really?
Yep. It shows you the tutorial compressor, and it's right in the very beginning of the chapter. It says, electromagnetic fusion containment engines.
There you are, caller.
Okay, thanks for the recommendation.
Right. Thank you very much for the call. Have a good morning. First time caller line, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Good morning, Art. This is Wade in Sand Point, Idaho.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'd ask a question for David. Maybe you covered it a little bit earlier there. Am I to understand that with the magnetic field produced by this, that contains the heat of this reaction?
Right. It contains the force and the heat.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, can you throttle that, or is it just one force?
Sounds like a mechanic to me. Yes, you can, and the way you do that is the way you increase-decrease speed of a rocket engine is by opening and closing an orifice called specific impulse. In this particular case, in the liquid fuel configurations, even the solid propellants, they can do that by a mechanical device called a jetivator, where they can it works like an iris of a camera. In this particular case, I used a plasma charge beam, an ion beam that opened the field up at the end. And by dilating that thing, I can increase or decrease, or as you say, throttle the engine.
Okay, so you're just basically you're changing the shape of the magnetic cone at the end. Right?
Man, what smart colors you got, Art. Yeah. God, I can't believe it.
Well, thank you, Art.
Thank you, sir. Have a good morning. Time perhaps for one more. Wildcard line, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. This is Frank in Seattle. I do some research for Richard Hoagland, and I just wanted to...
Well, then he's going to be on tomorrow night, you might want to know.
Well, I do know already about that because I'm in touch with him.
All right.
But what I want to call about is regards to... I've seen the STS-80 video that you have as well, Art.
Yes, I do. It's a mind-blower.
It really is. And I was just wondering...
David, there's no question about it. STS-80, the video that I have, shows things going on.
Right. Steve Beer showed it to me, and I'm telling you, I couldn't believe... I called up some friends at NASA, and I said, ice particles. I said, come on, guys, you got to come up with a better lie than that. That one's so bad, it's not working out
here.
Yeah,
not on that video, it doesn't.
Oh, it's not ice particles. It doesn't even look anything near it.
No, I know.
I've never seen ice particles do 90-degree corners.
By the way, I've got another question, too. On the engine you saw at Area 51, did you notice there was any fiber optic particles or strands or
anything
with fiber optics?
Yep.
Yeah, do you remember me talking about the surface, the little tubing?
Right.
The tubing looked just like fiber optics, except it looked like it had a liquid in it, but it had the same texture and look of a fiber optic cable system.
Right, and one other thing, too. Would you mind maybe perhaps getting in touch with our Richard Hoagland calling you or getting in touch with you on a couple of these things?
No, I'll be glad to talk to the guys. Like I said, I only had one problem that he said.
I have one other question. Thank you, caller. We're so short on time.
Call me.
On the engine.
Yes, sir.
On the engine, David, were there any markings?
Boy, I wonder if we about forgot that. This thing was covered with it.
Oh, God. With what?
It looked like it was like a cross of hieroglyphics and an alphanumeric system, but some of the stuff even had that. It looked almost like a lot of the emblems had the look of a playing deck of cards. You ever seen the clubs and the hearts?
Yes.
There was emblems like that. But, boy, I tell you what, those markings saved my bacon in Washington. I forgot to tell you that. They were testifying, the other witnesses, and I thought, boy, if nobody's had hardware contact, and I thought, man, I know what a turkey feels like at Thanksgiving, because I was the only one that had hardware contact at that time. And what happened was a lawyer got up to testify, and he was an encryption officer in 1960, and they gave him three pieces of metal, his commanding officers, and said that this is from a downed UFO. And so this guy is an attorney under oath now. You think about this. This
Real
lawyer,
quick, we're running out of time.
Okay. Anyway, I matched the emblems. I wrote them down and handed them to the guy, and he goes, holy smokes. So I matched the emblems that he remembered.
Incredible.
And that metal came off the engine.
David, we're out of time. We got to go. We're going to do it again.
All right.
Stay in touch, my friend.
Oh, thanks, Art, for having me on, bud.
Thank you. Take care. David Adair. If you want a copy of this program, 1-800-917-4278. That's 1-800-917-4278. Good night.